Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, I'm going to talk about the grand pension heist that is coming as the Corbett administration, along with their Republican lackeys, set their sights on, well, screwing workers even more, going after pensions. We're going to talk about that. Also going to talk about small business leaders who met with President Obama today. We're going to talk to one of those folks who was in the room, what the president had to say, because as you know, disaster is near. Also going to talk about poverty and the welfare queen. I think she's been spotted. I think we got a pretty good idea who the true welfare queens, who they are. Walmart, big corporations, GE, the welfare queens who are robbing us blind. Also, we're going to talk about strippers standing up for their rights on the job and so much more. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also contact me, Rick, at therickssmithshow.com. So 35 days left. That's it. It's the end of civilization. Unless you think, 12-12 is going to be the end, which I've had a couple people email me. They've said they've got their affairs in order. They're ready for the end of the world. 12-12. I'm not buying it. I've lived through a number of the end of the world scenarios where the religious folks tell me that they've looked through the book and they have deciphered the code, which is telling them 12, 12, 12 is it. That's it. It's just the end of the world. No more. It's all over. But beyond that, let's say we do make it to the 13th. We wake up and, 13th, we're still here. Rest assured, the end of the world is just 35 short days from today. December 31st, when the clock strikes midnight, it's all over. The end of civilization. The fiscal cliff, we've gone over. It's over. All over. So let the games begin between now and then. As I've been calling it, the fiscal mirage. So the fiscal mirage and casino are open for business. And the nonsense shall begin. Especially, I love the whole Republicans coming out and saying, oh, well, we're willing to raise revenue. They won't say raise taxes. They're hell-bent on not saying that. They've been programmed. They've been conditioned. They've been beaten with whips and chains and who knows what else to never say they're going to raise taxes. They're going to raise revenue. We're looking at the revenue side. You're going to raise taxes. Unless you're Mitt Romney, who, while he was governor, just raised fees on people like you and me. And expect that to happen. Look, you got to know, when you look at both sides of the political spectrum, the Republicans, if they're talking about raising revenue, it's coming off of your back. It's coming off of my back. We're going to be the ones getting screwed in this. And you know one of the top things on there is the home mortgage deduction. And I got to be honest, I'm okay with capping it. Maybe saying, hey, you couple hundred thousand, that's it. Unless you're in like California where house prices are just through the roof. Or maybe you're capping it and say, you know what, tough, we're not going to build those houses anymore. Let working class people be able to afford housing. But I look at all of this, and man, you got to, and I guess a part of, I was just talking to a friend today, and I said, what's amazing to me is, I think it's an American thing where we only listen to half of what somebody says. We only read half a sentence. We only hear half of what, like Lindsey Graham and Saxby Chambliss and Senator Corker from Tennessee and the whole list of Republicans who have said that they're willing to raise revenue. The second half of the statement is, if the Democrats are going to do substantial entitlement reform, which basically means screwing me down the road, screwing workers down the road. And much like we do with the Second Amendment. We love that. They love the first half. It's the second half not so thrilled about. And for me, this whole fiscal mirage should be about right now. What we should be doing is doing what we can agree on. And I do believe that both sides of the aisle don't want to raise taxes on working people, don't want to raise taxes on folks who are making $50,000 or $100,000 a year. And I got to be honest, for me, I say you over $50,000, we should be raising a little bit. If things are as bad as they're telling us, if the future is so dire, if our debts, if we're truly going to be Greece, which, if you listen to the Republicans, we're already there. We're just days away from being Greece. Which, if you look at the situations, we're nowhere even close to being Greece. In fact, you know, you look around the world and you look at the investors, and you know, one of the things that I do is I look at where would Warren Buffett and the wealth class put their money? You know where the global wealth class is putting their money? That's right here in the U.S. In fact, you know, I saw a thing that they were getting, I think it's like 2% return on their money for 30 years. Who in their right mind would tie up their money for 30 years if we're going over the cliff? If it's over? I mean, this whole fiscal mirage, this whole thing that they've created, and understand, this is a created crisis. This is what happened when you put T-Twits in charge. These automatic spending cuts and the triggers, love that. Oh, a good gun reference, right? We're going to have the trigger. We're going to pull the trigger on those spending cuts and the sequestration and basically ending the Bush tax cuts, ending the extension of unemployment benefits, ending the payroll tax breaks, all in favor of this poison, this austerity, this we're going to cut, gut, and punish, and we're going to go after those people. This is not a cliff. They keep calling it that. Oh, it's the fiscal cliff. Oh, we've heard it 1,000 times. It's not. And I've heard people, oh, it's the fiscal slope. It's not even a slope. It doesn't exist. This is extortion. This is a ripoff. This is a con. It's a strong arm game. And we can't fall for this. Because what they're talking about isn't about reducing our deficits. It's about punishing people. Especially working people. When we should be focusing on, hey, how do we get people back to work? How do we create jobs? How do we get people paying taxes? That's what we should be doing. But no, we've got to play these games. Because, well, the end of the world is coming. Or so they keep telling us. The cliff, it's coming. The end of it, it's all over. And you've even got some Democrats, and Dick Durbin was giving a speech over at the Center for American Progress. And he said, look, you know, at the end of this, we can't be so naive to believe that just taxing the rich can solve our problems. He said that, you know, his caucus needs to be open to issues painful and hard for them to talk about. You know, he's not in favor of making Medicare a voucher program or block grants for Medicaid, but, you know, we should be looking at things that we don't want to. And I say, okay, I'm willing to look at things that are going to be painful for the working class after everything else. My problem is this, like every crisis that the right creates, like every one of these situations, and understand, here in Pennsylvania, we're going to be hearing about the pension, oh, the pension crisis, oh, it's the sky's falling, oh! Whenever they create these crises, whenever they create these situations, it's always you and me who end up getting the short end of the stick. It's always working people. It's always more concessions from us because, oh, I got to share the pain. Well, I'm sorry. I don't see the 1% sharing the pain, especially when you look at the fact that 93% of all new income gains since the Great Recession that they created went to them. I'm not seeing the sharing. You know, there was a recovery that happened in this country. I don't know if you know it. But we didn't share in it. Working people didn't. What we got is we got a situation where we need 20 million people need jobs. They need full-time work, and they need it now. And this idea that, oh, more tax cuts. Oh, if we just get more tax cuts to those creators, the job creators. If we just give them more, they'll create jobs, which is nonsensical. And you know, how much of my life do I have to go through hearing the lie over and over and over and over and over again? I mean, how long do we have to put up with that before we just go, no, you're wrong, stop it. Stop it. What we should be talking about is, you know what? We raise taxes on the very wealthy, the people who have done wildly well in the last 30 years, that those 400 people that Warren Buffett talked about that have seen their wealth go up by 500% in just 20 years. Those are folks maybe we could ask a little bit of help from. and you go after the big corporations and you get them to pay their fair share. You don't go after Social Security. And Social Security should be completely off the table in this discussion. It shouldn't even be considered. And I think Jay Carney said something to that effect earlier today, that it shouldn't even be there because it doesn't. He says we should address the drivers of the deficit, and Social Security is currently not a driver of the deficit. And as Harry Reid has said in the past, Social Security hasn't added one single penny, not a dime, not a nickel, not a quarter, nothing to our budget problems. It never has. And for the next 30 years, it won't do that either. So the more they talk about, oh, we got to fix Social Security, I can fix Social Security immediately. You just take the cap off. It is that simple. But our wealthy friends, that's no. No, that would mean raising taxes on them. It's okay for you. It's okay for me. It's okay for people who swing a hammer and drive a truck and cut grass and paint buildings and do all the work that gets done in this country to pay tax on 100% of the income that we earn. But I make a gamble on Wall Street? And you want me to pay? How dare you? I mean, we should be, and I go back to my grandparents' generation who I think got it. I think they're the folks who said, you know, we need to invest in our children. We need to invest in education. We need to invest in healthcare. We need to invest in the next generation because those are the people who are going to take care of us when we get older. We don't need to be continually giving money to the big oil companies who are making billions. We shouldn't be giving more subsidies to the big drug companies who don't need it, to agribusiness who doesn't need it. And we certainly shouldn't be rebuilding places like Afghanistan and Iraq as our nation crumbles. Start there. And then come to me when we've done all of the other things. And say, okay, we've done our due diligence. We've done everything we can possibly do to hold harmless the working people, the struggling middle class in this country who this economy is crushing. We've done all we can do. Now we got to ask for some help. And here's what you're going to get for that. Here's where we're going to use that money, and here's how. It's the same thing with the hostess situation. You know, working people don't mind struggling. They don't mind sacrificing. But it better damn well help us. That's what I ask. Anyway, we're going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Questions, comments, thoughts, something on your mind, you can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show. One of the proudest progressive victories of the November elections was produced by some scrappy citizens in the burg of Brecksville, Ohio, population 14,000. Organized under the banner of Brecksville Citizens for Transparent Politics, they decided they needed to speak out about the U.S. Supreme Court's outrageous edict allowing unlimited sums of corporate cash to flood secretly into America's elections. So they collected signatures to qualify an initiative for the local ballot, calling for a U.S. constitutional amendment, quote, to establish that corporations are not people and money is not speech. A couple of states and dozens of cities proposed similar initiatives, but Brecksville's unique proposal added a useful bit of oomph to the call. If passed, it would require city officials to designate one day in February for the next 10 years as Democracy Day, on which the mayor would host a citywide hearing about how the surge of campaign money was affecting the city. After the hearing, the mayor must send a letter to the legislature and Congress proclaiming the citizens' opposition to corporate electioneering. Mayor Jerry Ruby, however, balked at this outbreak of democracy, saying it required the city to take an official position on a federal issue outside its jurisdiction. He went to the Board of Elections to disqualify it from the November ballot, but the board deadlocked, and the matter went to Ohio's Secretary of State. To the mayor's surprise, this Republican official broke the tie in favor of the citizens. Then, the mayor appealed to the Ohio Supreme Court, where, finally, with barely a month to go, a 5-2 majority of the judges ruled that the people's proposal was legit. This is Jim Hightower saying, completing this triumph of citizens' perseverance, 52% of Brecksvillians proudly voted the initiative into law on Election Day. See? It is possible to fight City Hall. And win.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
What keeps you up at night, Governor? What part of all of those worries concerns you the most? The cuts, the tax
cuts? Usually I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I wonder where we are going to balance the budget. We have a pension crisis just like every other state just about has a pension crisis.
You've had success. I want our viewers to know you've balanced 2 previous budgets, if not more. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've closed deficit holes of more than $4 billion. You've had success.
You've had success, success in kicking 41,000 working people off of the adult basic program, low-wage workers who needed very minimal health coverage, kicked them right to the curb, some 88,000 kids, kicked them off of Medicaid, some 70,000 of the state's most vulnerable, eliminated the general assistance. Yeah, you've had success. Cut $1 billion from public education each of the last 2 years. You have had success. Yes, sir. If that's success, please, please, let's get rid of this guy. Our tweet of the day comes from John Delano out in the Pittsburgh area. He says, public pension crisis could mean the loss of high school football by 2019. His story tonight. So we might want to tune in. And I'm going, you know, really, is that the worst thing you can come up with? I guess out in his area, that is very important. I've got Ted Kirsch. He's the president of AFT Pennsylvania on the line. This pension issue, this thing's just got me all worked up. Again, another ripoff of working people in the making. Ted, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, once again, it's a great pleasure to be talking to you, Rick.
You know, I look at this, you know, I sat in on the Republicans' hearings, their proposals that they've put forth in this pension reform, they're calling it, this crisis that's been created by bad investment, by bad decisions of the past, not by the people, not by the workers, not by the people who are the folks who are going to end up getting screwed in this. I look at this, and what they're telling me is they want to destroy the system as it is, and it's going to cost me more in the long run. Am I getting this right?
You got it right, and look who they're blaming again for the problem, the workers. The Budget Report Office put out a report yesterday, and remember, this is a report that's coming from Governor Corbett because his guy Zogby is the boss there. And once again, they're using scare tactics. Calling pensions a tapeworm or Pac-Man eating away at the budget, saying that they're trying to protect taxpayers. You have to remember, the average state pension in Pennsylvania is only $24,000 a year. That's what most people are getting on an average. Now, there is a problem. Now, why is there a problem? Because from 2000 to 2010, that's a 10-year period, the state didn't pay what it was supposed to pay into the pension fund.
Right.
They gave school districts a pension contribution holiday. Oh, you don't have to make your payment and your fair share. The only people who actually were paying their fair share during that 10-year period were the employees that were making their full contribution. So this is a problem that was created by the state. And I should point out, in addition, there were 2 hits in the stock market that helped create the problem. And now they're talking about a $41 billion with a B deficit. Now, there was an interesting report today that said that these people who do all the investments, that if you have 80% of your money put away, then the fund is healthy.
Right.
When they say $41 billion, they're talking about 100%. And right now, the public school employees' pension fund, it's funded at 69%. So the real problem that nobody's talking about is only 11%.
And what they're also, as I'm reading through their report, because I read it as well, what they're taking as forever is the economic crisis that we're in now. We're still in. We're still recovering. They're assuming that nothing is going to get better in the future and that, you know, it's going to stay the same. If we were creating jobs, if we were getting people back to work, those 20 million people who don't have jobs right now and aren't paying taxes, if we had those people and they had an economy that was moving forward, I don't think we'd have this problem.
That is correct. You don't hear the governor talking about dealing with the current economic problems, getting jobs, getting people back to work.
Because he hasn't done anything.
He's taken success for balanced budgets. He balances budgets by cutting budgets. Listen, this problem we saw coming. The public employee unions in 2010, with bipartisan support in this day and age, can you believe Republicans and Democrats and unions working together to deal with this pension problem? And so there were some changes made, and it's called Act 120.
Correct.
We increased employee contributions, capped the annual retirement benefit, increased the retirement age, increased from 5 to 10 the number of years you need to be vested for a pension, and even agreed that if we don't make the right contribution rate, that we'll share in trying to make up the increases. So there was an attempt just 2 years ago to solve the problem. Now Corbett comes along and he's blaming the people for the inaction of so many of his supporters.
Let me ask you, you brought up Act 120, and I've asked this question before. I mean, in the short period of time that it's been law, has it had a chance to work? I mean, have the things that that were done back then had a chance to take hold and actually try and help the system?
Well, it's hard in a two-year period to say that these changes will have an impact. The projections were over a period of time that they will have a significant, increase in trying to solve the problem. But that act was an attempt on the part of everyone to solve the problems. But there are other ways of solving the problems. You know, we've been paying our fair share all along.
Right.
When you look at his tax cuts and tax breaks for these corporations where 810 million dollars have been cut in taxes to corporations that states not getting, depreciation loopholes that were created, $760 million, and then of course I've been on the show before and I keep talking about our natural resources that we have in Pennsylvania. How do you not tax these profitable oil companies in the shale? Now, I know it's a double-edged sword. There are people who believe we shouldn't even be doing it, but they are doing it. They're taking money, and they're not paying for it.
Yep.
And the public isn't getting the benefit of it.
And not to mention the Delaware loophole. I mean, at some point, we've got to address that as well. And not to mention, I mean, you look at House Bill 2626 that they passed. That is going to allow employers to keep the employees' state income tax contributions and not tell us where it's going. I know they capped it at $5 million, but that's still $5 million that could have been spent helping the pension situation, helping the education situation, but we just gave that away with no oversight, no worry about where it's going to go.
Yeah, and you know what bothers me about the report, and I know probably many listeners haven't had an opportunity to read it, and it's online, but the part of the scam is saying, well, if you're presently retired, you don't have to worry. And then if you're presently employed, you don't have to worry. But that is not an accurate position to take.
Right.
You know, the people in Rhode Island who were retired thought the same thing, and they're saying, well, we've got all these court cases. We have all this precedent. When you talk to the lawyers, guess what? You take a case and you bring it, and it goes to the state Supreme Court. Look at the numbers. Look who's on the court. They make a ruling, and there goes all your precedents. This is Pennsylvania. We know what happens when cases go to the Supreme Court. Look what happened with the voter ID law. So the people who the governor trying to say, well, don't worry if you're retired, you do have to worry.
Anytime someone tells me not to worry, I start to worry.
Yeah, and there's some other reason. They haven't put out all of their proposals yet. I mean, there's scuttlebutt in Harrisburg about what some of the plans are. The whole concept of Social Security, all right, those of us who are working presently are paying in, and someday when we retire, we're going to get our money. That's, we have a defined benefit plan. We know what we're going to get. They're now talking about a defined contribution plan, which means you put in a certain amount, but you're not guaranteed what you're going to get in return. And if you don't put money into this retirement system, people who are presently retired and people who are going to retire, who's putting the money in to pay for it? And they're not talking about it. So this is a real serious issue that we have to be watching very, very carefully, the machinations of the governor and what they are reporting to the public. It's not accurate. Yep. They keep saying, we're trying to look out for the taxpayers' money. Okay, true. Who are some of these taxpayers? Aren't the people who are presently working taxpayers? The people who are members of these funds who are making their contribution, they're taxpayers as well.
But beyond that, I mean, I look at it from my perspective, Ted, and like I said, I sat in on their hearings on this issue, and every one of their experts said, if we go from a defined benefit to a defined contribution, it's going to cost the taxpayers of Pennsylvania considerably more, because you've got to keep the defined benefit plan until it runs out, and then you've got to fund the defined contribution, so you're splitting the pie. It's actually going to cost much more throughout the years. But the response from the folks who are pushing this was, well, it's what we should be doing anywhere. It's their ideology. It's not heaped in fact. It's not heaped in saving taxpayers a dollar, which, you know, it infuriates me to hear, oh, we're protecting the taxpayer. Nonsense. The facts are what they are. When you switch to from a defined benefit to a defined contribution, it's going to cost us more. It's that simple.
And who's going to profit? There's a profit here. Just like, and I've said this before, how all these profiteers and people making money with charter schools. Who's going to make profit when you go to a defined contribution? Hedge funds, yep. Investors. It's a money-making deal, and nobody's even talking about that aspect.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and this is what worries me, is they have the talking points. I mean, the right wing, Corbett and the Republicans have the talking points because, like you pointed out, it's only $24,000 a year that the folks who are working for the state, the teachers and the state workers get in pensions. The sad reality is most workers in this country, they don't have any pension. And what bothers me is we've become a nation that says, well, I don't have a pension, even a $24,000 a year pension, so you shouldn't either.
That's exactly what their spin is, and they're preying on the people who don't. Instead of us saying this is America, the land of plenty, everyone should have it. Same thing with health care. How can this country, unfortunately Obama won again, so we're going to be protected, many people who wouldn't have had health care. But the whole argument is that people shouldn't have health care. It's the same thing with pensions. Everybody should have a pension.
Yep.
You work your entire life. You make your contributions to society, and then you get into your senior years. Why shouldn't you be protected with a pension?
How do we stop this, Ted? I mean, how do my listeners go about making sure that this situation is protected, one, for the workers, but also for the taxpayers as well?
Well, I think there's two things that have to be taken as a course of action to go forward. Number one, we have to become educated in the issues. You know, many people are just hearing about this for the first time, which is why I'm glad I have an opportunity to speak to your listeners tonight. This is new to a lot of people. So, number one, we've got to educate ourselves to the issues. And number two, we have to, again, this is all going to be done by the state legislature. We have to become very active in terms of our lobbying activities in Harrisburg. And it doesn't just start when Corbett gives his budget. It's going to start before Corbett gives its budget, because it's starting now, and we're going to have to follow and work hard so that we don't make some wrong financial decisions to benefit a few and to punish. And it really is talking about punishing people.
Yeah, you know, I look at this, and the more I think about this whole push, because I think Sears and Piecers, I think they do a pretty good job of investing. I think they're professional at what they do and have done very well in spite of the massive collapse we had in 2008 and the Bush recession of 2001 and 2003. I see this as a way for Wall Street, for the private equity people, for the hedge fund managers to divorce workers from their pensions and the people who professionally manage them. So that like any hunt, if you will, you divide people, you get people away from the herd. This way you can rip them off, kind of like they've done with 401ks.
That's exactly right. And you mentioned Wall Street and the stockbrokers. If you go to a defined contribution plan and you start investing, where are you investing? Wall Street, stocks. That's part of the reason we have the problem, because of the two bad downturns that we had. Now we're going to put our entire faith in these people?
I'm telling you, we've got to stand up and fight this. And, people like, for taxpayers like me, I want to make sure that, one, we have a solid pension system so that the workers who are working for those benefits get them, and that they spend that money in our economy, and two, that we have the dollars that we're paying in spent the right way and not going into the Bain Capitals and the hedge fund managers and the Wall Street. It's, for me, Ted, it's just that simple.
And that's what we have to educate ourselves about. This is a whole new field. Most people never thought about retirement and benefits until they're getting close. And what do they think about? What am I going to get? How much is my check going to be each month? And that's to the extent that people would think and worry about retirement. But this is a much more serious problem, because a lot of what we thought we were going to get is now going to be placed in jeopardy.
Yeah, it's scary stuff. As this continues, I'd love to have you back and keep us informed on what's going on, if you wouldn't mind.
It's a pleasure to be on. I'm always available for you and your listeners.
Ted Kirsch, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ted Kirsch, president of AFT Pennsylvania. Quick break, back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Factory fires in Bangladesh highlight the importance of U.S. factory safety regulations, Jesse Russell reports.
It's a headline that could have been torn straight from the front page of a late 19th century newspaper reporting on the United States. More than 100 dead after being trapped in a garment factory fire. Except the story isn't unfolding 100 years ago in the United States. It unfolded in Bangladesh this weekend. The weekend fire, which claimed the lives of at least 112 workers, is being called one of the worst industrial accidents in that country's history. According to the Clean Clothes Campaign, more than 500 workers have died in Bangladesh factory fires over the last 6 years. Following the factory fire, thousands protested in the streets demanding the government address safety standards in those factories. One of the alleged reasons for so many deaths in the fire was that managers had padlocked the first floor doors, so workers were forced to jump from the roof to nearby buildings or out of windows. Such practices echo the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in 1911 New York City, when 146 garment workers died partially because managers had locked doors to stairwells and exits.
That clothing factory supplied Walmart and other major retailers. United Food and Commercial Workers President Joe Hansen says his union is proud to stand with the Walmart workers as they strike, protest, and do direct action protests to improve working conditions at Walmart and to inform customers about conditions there. Gregory Fletcher is a California Walmart worker.
They pay low. They pay very low. A lot of times people tell me, well, what, you know, you're not really a doctor, you're not a lawyer. I mean, you know, how much money do you expect to make at Walmart? But the point I make is that if the company's making over $400 billion a year in sales, I must be pretty valuable.
The National Domestic Workers Alliance is out with a new report showing domestic workers face not only poverty-level wages, but are also subject to high levels of abuse. Home Economics, the invisible and unregulated world of domestic work, surveyed more than 2,000 domestic workers in 14 U.S. cities. The report found that 23% are paid less than the minimum wage, and 48% of domestic workers are paid less than adequate wages to support a family. They're also subjected to verbal, physical, and psychological abuse on the job with no recourse. Ai-Jen Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, says these workers deserve protections afforded by U.S. law. The alliance is calling for including domestic workers in state minimum wage laws, adding them to workers' compensation and unemployment insurance programs, guaranteeing overtime pay, meal and rest breaks, and protecting domestic workers under all state and federal anti-discrimination laws. The Association of Minor League Umpires has re-elected President Sean Francis and also added two new executive board members. The association is a guild affiliated with the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. The new leadership will negotiate labor agreements for the umpires in 2013.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And I always feel like somebody's watching me.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone, take the program on the go. You know, I look at this pension situation, and again, it's another one of these, just like the fiscal mirage, just like the debt ceiling debacle, just like all of these created crises, all of these extortion schemes, all of these hostage situations, all of this stuff, what they do, and you got to give them credit, they know how to work us. They know how to divide. And I was telling someone today, you know, the Jay Gould quote, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. Well, we're not killing each other right now. What we're doing is we're trading away our future so that the wealth class can have a little bit more. And you think about what they've been able to do throughout the years you think about the defined benefit pension fund. And I think about my grandfather's generation. I brought in the contract that he worked under while he was a Teamster. And you look at the benefits and you look at the wages and you look at all the things that this industry has given up over the years because, oh, there's been a crisis. Oh, we need concessions. This is not new, folks. This is what the wealth class does. They create a crisis. They create the fiscal mirage, the debt debacle. They create all this stuff so that they can come back to us and say, well, you know, working class guy, you know, we need shared sacrifice. We need to roll up our sleeves and get this done. And that means, well, we're going to push off Social Security another 2-3 years down the road to where you're not going to get it. And Medicare, the same thing. I mean, they've been doing this for generations. It's not new. Which is why I said about the hostess situation. I supported the bakery workers because I thought they were right. Enough is enough already. And at some point, we've got to say enough is enough already as well. It's just that simple. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Earth, sky.
Tuesday, November 27th,
full moon tonight and a penumbral eclipse of the moon.
This 2012 November full moon is the smallest full moon of this year. North America will see the penumbral eclipse of the moon before sunrise November 28th. As seen from the world's eastern hemisphere, Europe, Africa, Asia, Indonesia, Australia, and New Zealand, the full moon passes through Earth's penumbral shadow after sunset on November 28th.
This isn't a total eclipse of the moon, or even a partial. A penumbral eclipse is a very special kind of eclipse. The penumbra is the light outer shadow of Earth. What's happening is that this light shadow brushes the moon's face. Your best chance of noticing any shade at all on the moon's surface is at mid-eclipse, and in a dark sky, not obscured by dusk or dawn.
And actually, this eclipse might even be more exciting to watch if you could view it from the moon. At or near the moon's north pole, you'd see our planet Earth covering about 90% of the sun's diameter.
So that's tonight. Full moon, smallest full moon of the year, and a very subtle penumbral lunar eclipse. For eclipse times, visit the Tonight page at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight. The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your rights. Come on, get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
And stand up and say no to the fiscal mirage. I know they keep telling us at the end of the world, 35 days, it's all over. We're going off the deep end. It's the end of civilization as we know it. There'll be massive economic calamity. The world will, in fact, the planet will stop rotating. It's the end. It's over. That's if we make it past 12-12. But I'm telling you, this is a construct. And this is the kind of stuff that we need to say enough of. No more. And I'm glad that there are people, small business owners in this country, who get it. And I look at the folks at the American Sustainable Business Council, a group of about 600 small business owners from across the country and executives who signed a letter for the American Sustainable Business Council, who said, you know what? End that those costly handouts for the top 2%. Keep the tax cuts where they are for working people. But you know what? Those folks who have done wildly well, let's ask them to do a little bit more. And that's why I've asked Lou Prince. He is the owner of, well, the largest independent music store in the Midwest. It's called Vintage Vinyl. Great place there in St. Louis. Lou, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick. Hey, thanks. Thanks for Bob Marley. It's always good to hear the master on the radio.
There you go. Well, we take pride in the music that we play here.
You always do it right.
Yeah. So I guess today you had an opportunity to meet the man himself today.
It was wild. You know, I really am just the working guy from St. Louis. I mean, I'm not a six-figure anything. And, you know, I've run a local community business with, right now we've got 15 full-time and 9 part-time employees for 33 years. And I found myself sitting at a table with 15 much younger, much hipper entrepreneurs who also own small businesses, sitting at the same table with the president, with Vice President Biden, with Karen Mills, the head of the Small Business Administration, with the head of the Office of Management and Budget, with the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, with a president who actually wanted to ask what we thought. It didn't feel like I was being stroked. And it was pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, what'd you tell him? I mean, for me, the response is, well, we need customers. You need to get money into people's pockets so they can buy my stuff.
That is what we talked about. People in that room on the small business side said we need a higher minimum wage. We need to protect the Bush-era tax cuts for the middle class.
Hold on. Let me stop you right there. Wait a second. 6 business owners, small business people sitting around a table saying we want a higher minimum wage?
And, in fact, the guy who brought it up, David, I don't know his last name, called himself a reformed. I think he worked for either Lehman Brothers or Goldman Sachs as an investment banker who now owns a small business. And he was the first guy to say, you know, you want to put money in the hands of people, kick up the minimum wage. You know, I've been campaigning around Missouri for years to get the minimum wage to $10. which would only get us even with about 1966's money value.
Right.
But I think it's as far as you can do it politically right now, if you can do it at all. The people at that table, the really interesting thing to me, we're all small businessmen, business owners. I would have to say there were probably less than half men, and mostly young, who didn't come there to ask for a special tax loophole, for a carried interest deduction, for a way to hide their money overseas, but came to ask for nothing for themselves and only came to say, we support the Bush-era tax cut for the middle class, and we don't think rich people are taxed enough in this country. And it was just, I was proud to be there. I was really happy to be there.
And what was the response from the president?
The man is listening. The man is on our side. And I think what they need is a way to push back against the lobbyists. I think what the liberal Democrats need, including the administration, is enough of the working people in this country to call their congressman, call their senator, and say enough of BS, enough baloney. Don't hold us for ransom so rich people can keep getting 70% of their profits to take home instead of like 66% of their profits to take home. It's baloney.
Yeah, I agree.
And they know it. I think what they need is the people in your audience to do that, to call their congressman, call their senator, especially if they're Republicans, but even Blue Dog Democrats. I come from Missouri. We've got a fine senator, but she's essentially a moderate.
Yeah.
And
could have been much worse. It could have been much worse.
Oh God. Well,
you could have been like Pennsylvania.
I used to live in Todd Akin's district and I would tell people that my retirement job was going to be running against them every 2 years until he finally said something stupid enough that even those people wouldn't reelect him. So Claire beat me to it.
Well, yeah, good for her. But, you know, I look at this and, you know, we've been sold this, Lou, that, you know, if we give tax cuts to the very wealthy, if we keep paying homage to the chair, if we give them enough that their benevolence, their philanthropy, if you will create jobs.
Yeah, I know I've said this before on your show. There is no evidence whatsoever that tax cuts for the upper 2 or 3% have any effect on job creation in America, and that to say that is like saying you can start your car by pouring gasoline on the hood. It makes no sense whatsoever. And the Republicans are basically running a big lie on this one. People, you know, in the history of investing in America, the capital gains rates have never been this low. In the history of investing since we've had capital gains taxes. Right now, corporations take less of the GDP, give less of the GDP back in taxes, and individuals give less of the GDP in taxes than they have since the early 1950s. Right now, both of those numbers, the corporate number is incredibly low. The numbers add to about 15% of GDP, and in order to balance the budget, we need about 22%. And that money can be got from higher corporate taxes, higher individual taxes on the upper end, really simple things like capping deductions for the very wealthy. They don't need to take them from working people. They don't need to starve the social net, the social safety net. They don't need to cut back. To me, one of the really remarkable things in this meeting was it was clear that even the, you know, I really was about the oldest businessman there, that even the younger people there understood that maintaining our infrastructure, our education system, the community college system, was a gift that we got from previous generations that we owe our children to be able to hand down to them. And the reason we got it was these other people paid way more taxes to help support it. And these other people, the wealthy, have made their millions and billions on our highways, in our schools, you know, using our infrastructure, our electric grid that we built with our brains and our backs and our tax money too.
So let me ask you this. I mean, we keep hearing the canard that if we lose the Bush tax cuts for people over $250,000, which is what, you know, some of the Democrats are proposing, that's going to hurt people like you. It's going to hurt the people who are sitting around that table. How much of that is accurate?
I think no one at that table is anywhere close to that level of income. And I'm telling you, it was a great cross-section of American small business. And here's how I know that's the case. Of the people who report income from small businesses on their income tax, 3% of the individuals and 3% of the couples make over $200,000 for individuals and $250,000 for couples, which is that breaking point, 3%. The other 97% of people who report small business income on their taxes make less and would not be affected one iota by this tax cut, by this tax increase, not once. And the few who are over it, the 3%, remember, they're still getting the low rate on the first $250.
Right.
They're just getting asked to pay a little more on $251 and up.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, like I've advocated. Going back to the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower's tax cut. And I think we've had this conversation in the past because I'm a big fan of loopholes. I really am. I think we should be incentivizing certain behaviors and punishing others. So I believe we have a much higher rate so that, you know, we get people to do things what's in public good, what's in the interest of the country, not so much, well, the top 1%.
I'm with you. Don't get me started. You know, a list of things I brought in that meeting that there just wasn't enough time to talk about was I really think that income on dividends, income on capital gains should be taxed like the income on working people.
Good.
So that it isn't limited to 15 or 20%, although I think there's almost no way they're going to let it go without getting up to 20.
Well, what did he say when he brought that up? I mean, because, I mean, that's something that I've brought up a number of times. You know, why is gambling on Wall Street treated differently than me busting my butt?
Right. It demeans our labor. You know, I get a paycheck every week. I haven't gotten a dividend from my company in my life. I get a paycheck, and I pay at paycheck rates like a steel worker, which is about what I make, about what a steel worker makes. And to me, it demeans labor to say that capital is worth more. And I think that we can push our Democrats in Congress to this line. The president has a lot of leverage in these negotiations because this false, phony, constructed out of political air crisis has the Republicans scared. You know, they're going to get blamed. And they're in bad shape now.
They should. They did this.
Absolutely.
Come on, this is the Tea Party that did this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, because they keep putting, well, the cliff is coming. It's the end. The world's going to stop. But no, as easily as you did this, you can undo it.
The only thing that could happen that would be really bad for a lot of businesses is if they don't raise the debt ceiling, it could spike interest rates for some of these small businesses. You know, for me, I can never borrow money at a reasonable rate because as many bankers have said to me, records ain't collateral. No matter how many hundreds of thousands of dollars you have sitting in your store, I finally found a bank in St. Louis that was willing to give me a credit line at a reasonable rate. But it won't break the bank for me if it goes up a little bit.
So have you
a lot of these smaller guys, these entrepreneurs, it might.
Did you bring that up? I mean, because, you know, to me, we should be doing as a matter of our government, if we really wanted to, because we've got a jobs crisis.
Yeah.
If you haven't noticed, that's a real crisis. Why don't we give people like you the access to cheaper loans like we give to Goldman Sachs and to these big banksters who have destroyed our economy?
One of these things, that came up several times during the meeting, and again, the people from the administration were there to listen. They really weren't there to talk or hype their stuff. Was the availability of capital to smaller, riskier, more entrepreneurial businesses and how difficult that was. And I think they got that message pretty clearly. The people on the other side of the table, the administration people, they know the numbers. They know the games that are being played with the numbers. I got about 5 minutes personally with Vice President Biden at the end, and I told him, you guys need to win this on the facts. I think that the people trust the intellect of this administration and trust the basic factual honesty. Then if you go out and make the case, you can have a tidal wave of public support for way more than you think you can get from these Republicans, because people will react and respond
Yep.
to being spoken to like adults and shown the respect of a reasonable, factual argument, because they're not getting it from the other side and half of their own side.
And the hope is that, you know, they take a stand and they get a spine transplant to where they stand up and say, you know what, first club out of the bag isn't screwing Social Security up or voucherizing
right.
Medicare or doing any of those gimmicky things that the right wants to do, but actually going, you know, first club out of the bag is go, who's got the biggest shoulders? Who can carry the most water? Let's ask them first.
There you go. Who has been getting the most from the system that we all built? Who has been getting the most?
Well, according to Emmanuel Saez, the professor from Cal Berkeley, since 2009, 93% of all new income gains went to the top 1%.
Oh, yeah.
So there was a recovery. It's just that folks like you and me, Lou, we didn't benefit from it.
Well, and one of the things that bringing up the minimum wage sort of always leads to for me is we need to really strike at the heart of the disparity between the richest and the poorest in this country, and now between the richest and the middle class. And they can call it redistribution. They can call it whatever the heck they want. I call it simple economic justice.
Yep.
That if you believe, and I think most of the people at that table would say that what they want is just a chance at the starting gate to succeed in an American way and in the way that businesses have in America for a very long time, and that if the lobbyists, if the National Federation of Independent Business and the Chamber of Commerce, who were mentioned in the meeting, and I was the one who said, I think I can say that they represent not one business in this room, and everyone at the table went, oh, yeah. You know, you said that the American Sustainable Business Council represents 600 businesses, but what I can tell you is all of the organizations in this room, and one of the ones that I work with the most is called Business for Shared Prosperity. If you total up the number of businesses that are members of these organizations, it's 150,000 small businesses.
Wow.
Representing over 300,000 individual business owners and entrepreneurs. And it's a huge chunk of the American economy. You know, my other pet peeve always is healthcare in America. And, I didn't get to say it to the president, but I did get to say it to a cabinet member that we need to separate health insurance or health care
yep.
from our jobs so that we own it from birth.
Yep.
Just like you carry a Social Security card.
Absolutely.
You carry a health care card, and we need national health care.
I'm right there with you.
And that it would be a gift to not only every CEO in America, which would make them competitive with these European systems and the Japanese who already do that for their businesses, but it would be a gift to every union leader in America because it would take an issue off the table and give them access to other issues.
I'm right there with you. Lou,
And that's what it was about for me.
I appreciate the time. Congratulations on getting a couple of minutes. I'm glad to hear that it went well. I'm hoping that the president takes more time to actually talk to working people, and hopefully this bears out as these negotiations go forward. I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Same here, man. Good luck. Keep fighting.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Lou Prince, owner of Vintage Vinyl, the largest independent music store in the Midwest. Great guy. Quick break. Right back with Hour 2. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people, only 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Factory fires in Bangladesh highlight the importance of U.S. factory safety regulations, Jesse Russell reports.
It's a headline that could have been torn straight from the front page of a late 19th century newspaper reporting on the United States. More than 100 dead after being trapped in a garment factory fire. Except the story isn't unfolding 100 years ago in the United States. It unfolded in Bangladesh this weekend. The weekend fire, which claimed the lives of at least 112 workers, is being called one of the worst industrial accidents in that country's history. According to the Clean Clothes campaign, more than 500 workers have died in Bangladesh factory fires over the last 6 years. Following the factory fire, thousands protested in the streets demanding the government address safety standards in those factories. One of the alleged reasons for so many deaths in the fire was that managers had padlocked the first floor doors, so workers were forced to jump from the roof to nearby buildings or out of windows. Such practices echo the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in 1911 New York City, when 146 garment workers died partially because managers had locked doors to stairwells and exits.
That clothing factory supplied Walmart and other major retailers. United Food and Commercial Workers President Joe Hansen says his union is proud to stand with the Walmart workers as they strike, protest, and do direct action protests to improve working conditions at Walmart and to inform customers about conditions there. Gregory Fletcher is a California Walmart worker.
They pay low. They pay very low. A lot of times people tell me, well, what, you know, you're not really a doctor, you're not a lawyer. I mean, you know, how much money do you expect to make at Walmart? But the point I make is that if the company's making over $400 billion a year in sales, I must be pretty valuable.
The National Domestic Workers Alliance is out with a new report showing domestic workers face not only poverty-level wages, but are also subject to high levels of abuse. Home Economics, the invisible and unregulated world of domestic work, surveyed more than 2,000 domestic workers in 14 U.S. cities. The report found that 23% are paid less than the minimum wage, and 48% of domestic workers are paid less than adequate wages to support a family. They're also subjected to verbal, physical, and psychological abuse on the job with no recourse. Ai-Jen Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, says these workers deserve protections afforded by U.S. law. The alliance is calling for including domestic workers in state minimum wage laws, adding them to workers' compensation and unemployment insurance programs, guaranteeing overtime pay, meal and rest breaks, and protecting domestic workers under all state and federal anti-discrimination laws. The Association of Minor League Umpires has re-elected President Sean Francis and also added two new executive board members. The association is a guild affiliated with the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. The new leadership will negotiate labor agreements for the umpires in 2013.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raising but the wages. Everything's raising but the wages. Gas and groceries and our hazes. Everything's raising but the wages.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So I believe they have found the welfare queen, or as Alan Grayson pointed out, what I've been saying for years, the welfare queen, well, she wears a corporate cloak, if you will. He's pointing to Walmart, though. Alan Grayson was on TV, said, you know, the largest recipient of public aid in the country, that would be Walmart. Their model is set up where, you know what, taxpayers pay for the earned income tax credit. Taxpayers pay for Medicare, Medicaid. They pay for unemployment insurance when the hours get cut down. Public assistance, things like food stamps. Yep, though that's what the taxpayer pays for. And, well, the CEOs of Walmart, the six sperm lottery winners, $115 billion. Something seriously wrong, and I think he's right. I think Grayson's absolutely right. In state after state, Walmart employees represent the largest group of Medicaid recipients, the largest group of food stamp recipients, and taxpayers shouldn't have to bear that burden. Walmart should. You know, I look at this last presidential election, and one thing that we did not talk about, neither candidate really, I mean, Romney took shots at the 47%, but poverty was not one of the things that was front and center. Heard a lot of talk about the middle class, not much about the folks at the bottom end of the spectrum, which is why I've asked Randy L. Belda, economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Boston, to talk about her report, How Youth Are Put at Risk by Parents' Low-Wage Jobs, report just released. Randy, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this most recent, you know, presidential election. We didn't hear much out of either candidate about the poor, about poverty. I mean, Romney did take some shots at the 47% of folks who don't make enough to pay federal income tax, but nothing really on how we've helped those folks. You know, I guess the question then becomes, how do we help the people at the very bottom, the working poor in this country?
Well, probably the most important way is to make jobs better. That part of the new face of poverty in the United States is a low-wage worker. And both the the low wages and the quality of work are really what is keeping a lot of people down for a long time.
Yeah, you know, I just read something not too long ago. The woman who inherited like $30 billion in Australia, Ms. Regina Reinhardt's her name, said, you know, people should work for $2 an hour and they should stop socializing and drinking and they should work harder. And, you know, there's this mentality in this country that, you know, those people should just work harder. They should work more. And since, you know, the welfare reform of 96, I see that the working mothers are working more. Have they done any better?
Well, no. I mean, in fact, the answer for most people isn't work. I mean, that's the problem. People who can work do work if they can get a job, and if they can get the hours, they're happy to work them. The problem, of course, is that they don't pay very well. And the other problem, especially for parents, is that if you have to take a job and you have to take the hours you're given, you end up either not spending time with your kids or having to not be at work. It's sort of this terrible choice around do you make a little bit more by working, or do you give up time with your kids, and often important time with your kids, to fill a low wage job?
Now, you know, I think about, you know, when I read through some of your report, I started thinking about myself. You know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. My mother worked, you know, one of these low wage crummy jobs where, you know, last one hired, first one fired kind of thing, where it was all weird hours and I spent a lot of time by myself. Yeah. I didn't get to see her a lot. And I think about my kids, who fortunately their mother gets to stay at home and there's always someone there, and just a complete different world than what I grew up in. And for me, it was all about the opportunity of a job that paid well and, well, the union that I had that helped me make decent wages.
That's right. And, there are a lot of jobs that require some flexibility, but there are ways to negotiate that. And that's what unions do, right, is that they provide some mechanism by which both employers and workers can get shifts filled. But so many low-wage jobs in the United States, as you know, and talk about all the time, are not unionized or don't have any that kind of negotiation that goes on. And workers end up, like I said, you know, like your mother and other workers, either they have to work or they don't get the money. And it means for kids, it means on the one hand, someone like yourself, you probably had to take on a lot of responsibility because your mom wasn't around.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about, you used the term adultification.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, you know, it meant what you said. I would come home at first, second grade. I would make myself, a snack after. I would keep myself occupied, do my homework, and your mom would come home around 7 o'clock. In today's world, I think that's something that should not be happening. And we hear a lot of talk about family values. The family values, there should be someone home.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, you know, that's not the case for a lot of high-income families. I mean, their time is so deeply structured by adults being around all the time, right, the disparity is really stark, and that's part of our unequal America.
And what does it mean for the kids? I mean, you know, I think about myself, and I got into some trouble when I was a younger man because I had a lot of time where there was no supervision. What does it mean for the next generation?
Yeah, well, it's associated with a lot of things. One is worse schooling outcomes. One, if you're not at school, if you're taking care of younger kids, or if you know that somebody's not watching out for you. So there's one, these more higher dropout rates, obesity associated with early pregnancy, and then also, like I said, I mean, kids growing up fast. So what we found was that the impacts of low wage work don't stop, you know, when you leave the job. They spill over to families, and they spill over in important ways to young kids, not to very young kids, to adolescents, to teens. Right. Kids we tend not to think that much about when we think about poverty and low-wage work.
And through your study, did you see anything about, you know, the cycles? Because I would assume that, you know, you fall into the same kind of a cycle where the next generation follows the parents.
Yeah. Well, in many ways, you have to – give up things and go right, go into a low-wage job. So, yes, you don't have the opportunity to move on or move up. And it does tend to perpetuate these cycles of people not having the opportunity to move up and on.
You know, we hear an awful lot about, this whole family values thing, and I get a lot of the, this is a Christian nation, and the churches should be helping the poor, and, Romney with his 47% nonsense. How do we help the folks who are struggling at the bottom, the people who are the low-wage workers, the folks here in Pennsylvania who got kicked off of adult basic, the low-wage health insurance, because they could do it. How do we help these folks at the bottom, and is it politically feasible?
Oh, sure, it's politically feasible. It's sort of this multi-pronged approach. I think on the one hand, you have to have the sets of safety net programs that provide for people, especially when they don't have work, and to some degree when they have part-time work but you also need jobs that can pay a decent wage. Just last week, I think Demos put out a report that said something to the effect if we raised the minimum wage to a living wage for retail workers, it might cost people another 15 cents every time they went to the store. 15 cents isn't very much,
right?
For people to have a decent living. And actually, I think, and part of what they argued is true, is that if you increase the wages of people to lowest, what are they going to do with that money? They're going to go out and spend it.
It's a stimulus.
They probably spend it at the stores where, these retail stores where the other low-wage workers are working.
But here's the thing. I mean, you've got the wealth class of this country, and I think when you brought that up, I thought of Papa John's.
Yes.
Who said that he didn't want to raise the price of his pizza 11 cents so that all of his employees would have health care.
That's right. And for what? So he and the other, the other people who own Papa John's can have just a little bit more money?
And I don't know if you've seen his palatial estate. I don't know that he, and I hate to say this, but I think he's doing all right. I think 11 cents for health care, I think he could spare that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's an, people like to make this an economic question, but in many ways, it's an ethical question, a moral question. I mean, it's only an economic question in the sense that it's a matter of redistribution. And if anything, it's actually redistributive in positive ways, but also might contribute more to growth than what we're seeing.
Yeah. I spent a little time at home at my grandparents' house in Cleveland, and I came across some of their old union contracts because my grandmother was a retail clerk, like someone who would work at Walmart, and my grandfather was a truck driver. And in 1979, I was looking through one of the contracts, he was making almost $8 an hour, which in today's dollars would be $31 an hour.
Yeah.
And I go, this is the answer right here. People having contracts, having the ability to collectively bargain and get a share of the wealth that they create. To me, that's the answer.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think lifting the bottom and lifting wages, as well as the sets of benefits that go with good jobs, will go a long way, not just for these workers, but for their families. And that's what we point out in our report, especially young people. But also, I think, for communities and frankly, for our nation as a whole.
I was also looking at my grandmother's contract. As a retail clerk, they were getting paid double time on Sunday. I mean, this was the 80s. I mean, and that's not all that long ago.
Right.
And you stop and you think about all that the working class has given away. And right now we're talking about the grand fiscal mirage is what I've been calling it. But this created crisis where down the road they're going to push Social Security. They're going to go after programs that are going to help the very folks that we're talking about, all in the way of hoping to save tax handouts for the very wealthy.
That's right. I mean, it's really the people at the bottom. And actually, I've done a lot of work on this, too. It's women actually will be the ones hit hardest by these austerity plans in two ways. One, in that they mean cuts in government services generally, which means cuts in government employment at those levels, at the lower levels, which are mostly women workers, but also cuts to the services. And who are the recipients of those are lower income people, and who gets to pick up the pieces when those services aren't there? Women and their families. So there's a lot to lose in these debates that aren't even being talked about very much. In the same way that we didn't talk about poverty.
Not at all. I mean, it was not even discussed. I mean, because the sad reality is, and I think that the Romney people, you know, one of the guys actually said it, you know, poor people don't vote.
Right. Right. Well, and didn't Romney say, well, we don't have to worry about poor people because the government helps them?
Yeah. Yeah, we don't care about them. And, you know, well, I mean, that's a whole other show all in and of itself. So I guess the question I have from this point forward, I mean, you know, you go back and you look at the war on poverty of the Great Society and all of the, because I still remember a lot of those programs, mm-hmm. and all of the advancement that happened then of pulling people out of poverty, giving them opportunity. Can we do something like that again? I mean, how bad is it going to have to get before people start going, we need to have another movement towards, you know, living wage campaigns, towards decent wages? What's it going to take?
Well, I think we're beginning to see some of that. I think we're beginning to see, you know, for example, last Thursday with some of the Walmart strikes. A lot more is coming out about the conditions of low-wage work. Today, another report came out about domestic workers.
Right.
And historically, this is what you see. During periods of enormous inequality and the growth in families who can't support themselves, including individuals, you begin to see movements that start to organize people. You begin to see quote-unquote reformers, right, at the turn of the 20th century, they're called reformers, who start advocating at all levels. And so you push from below, you get some pull from above, and I think things start to happen.
Is this something that has to be done with legislation, or would you advocate like I do? Because I believe
both. I think you've got to have organizations, you've got to have advocates, you've got to have unions and groups, you know, and religious groups who take a moral stand, who argue, who fight. But you also at the same time you have to push and get legislation to make it last.
Yeah, I'm still hopeful. I mean, there's part of me like you said. I went and created my own Walmart strike. I went to one of the stores in Ohio and handed out leaflets and talked to the workers. And the workers, you know, secretly came up to me and said, "Hey, thanks for being here. We appreciate that someone cares."
Yeah. Oh yeah. No. And the quality, you know, the quality of people's lives has really eroded in large part. And often for the sake of somebody. Can have a million, you know, too much money.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, the six sperm lottery winners who inherited the Walmart Corporation, $115 billion collectively, and they've got workers who are getting their health care from the taxpayers. There's something seriously wrong with this.
Yeah.
The report is how youth are put at risk by parents' low-wage jobs. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Randy Albeda's name. It'll take you right there. Randy, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Well, thanks, and keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PCCU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
1 of the proudest progressive victories of the November elections was produced by some scrappy citizens in the burg of Brecksville, Ohio. Population 14,000. Organized under the banner of Brecksville Citizens for Transparent Politics, they decided they needed to speak out about the U.S. Supreme Court's outrageous edict allowing unlimited sums of corporate cash to flood secretly into America's elections. So they collected signatures to qualify an initiative for the local ballot, calling for a U.S. constitutional amendment, quote, to establish that corporations are not people and money is not speech. A couple of states and dozens of cities proposed similar initiatives, but Brecksville's unique proposal added a useful bit of oomph to the call. If passed, it would require city officials to designate one day in February for the next 10 years as Democracy Day, on which the mayor would host a citywide hearing about how the surge of campaign money was affecting the city. After the hearing, the mayor must send a letter to the legislature and Congress proclaiming the citizens' opposition to corporate electioneering. Mayor Jerry Ruby, however, balked at this outbreak of democracy, saying it required the city to take an official position on a federal issue outside its jurisdiction. He went to the Board of Elections to disqualify it from the November ballot, but the board deadlocked, and the matter went to Ohio's Secretary of State. To the mayor's surprise, this Republican official broke the tie in favor of the citizens. Then, the mayor appealed to the Ohio Supreme Court, where, finally, with barely a month to go, a 5-2 majority of the judges ruled that the people's proposal was legit. This is Jim Hightower saying, completing this triumph of citizens' perseverance, 52% of Brecksvillians proudly voted the initiative into law on Election Day. See? It is possible to fight City Hall. And win.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
We imagine a pink unicorn. Now, if you had a pink unicorn, how many dollars in taxes would you raise to trade for the pink unicorn? Since pink unicorns do not exist in the real world, it has never occurred to me to worry about the senator from South Carolina. He's not going to vote for a deal because the kind of 10-to-1 ratio deal he's talking about with real ironclad spending cuts is never going to happen.
Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows.
You know what else is not going to happen? You know what else is not going to happen? The wealth class is not going to create jobs if we give them money. It's not going to happen. You want pink fluffy unicorn? There it is. The more we give to the top 1%, the more they're going to keep. I'm sorry, this idea that, oh, if we give them more, the benevolence and the philanthropy of the wealth class, they'll just create job after job. Because they like us. Oh, man, I think we're dense when it comes to that issue. And I look at new data released by the Internal Revenue Service. Points out the fact that, you know, what we've been doing is wrong, but also that the effective tax rates that the wealth class pay in this country has fallen again, and it's lower than it was in 2010. And we knew this. Look, I mean, this is not some surprise. Oh, wow, really? We knew this. Come on. The average effective tax rate for people making over $500,000 fell again. It's been going on for years. For people with incomes over $10 million, the average tax rate fell from 22.4% in 2009 to 20.7%. Wall Street Journal points out the reason for the drop in average tax rates is no secret. It's the 15% top tax rate for capital gains and dividends that George W. Bush pushed through. They point out in 2009, taxpayers with incomes exceeding $10 million reported 35.8% of their income as capital gains and dividends. That's 2009. In 2010, that number went up to almost half, 48.5%. Which is why, like we talked about with Lou Prince a little bit ago, all income, and I don't care how you got it. Personally, I think gambling on Wall Street should be taxed a little bit higher than the guy who's busting his butt creating the wealth. But I'll take parity. So when David Tepper lays down his bet and makes $4 billion, he should pay the same tax rate as the guy who's stringing the power lines in New York because of Hurricane Sandy, putting his life on the line to make sure that others have an opportunity. The same tax rate that the fireman who ran into the towers on 9/11 got paid. The same as the cop, the same as the firefighter, the same as people who work for a living. But that's not how our tax code is set up. Because we want to encourage, you know, the very wealthy to, well, we want them to invest. Because it's risky, you know? Investing is risky. Yeah. Not today, because we make sure we have socialism for them, right? Who do we bail out? You look at all the bankruptcy proceedings. Oh, who do we worry about? The shareholders. And, you know, you think about General Motors and Chrysler. You think about the auto industry. The wealth class is furious that the workers got to keep some of their pension and got to keep a portion of their wages and that they lost a little bit. They're furious about it. One of the first times in history that the workers didn't get completely screwed, and they're nuts about it. You know, I go back to something else Lou Prince said. And again, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com is where you can download the podcast so you can go back and listen to that portion of the program. He said, look, we need to have people at the very top paying their tax rates, and we need to make sure that income is, you know, taxed like anything else, and that the Democrats have the stronger hand here, and I believe they do. I believe they have the stronger hand if they play it right. Because the reality is the majority of people in this country think we should be raising taxes on the very, very wealthy to help pay for programs that help the poor people. According to a CNN poll, 56% said, you know what, we need to be raising those top marginal tax rates to help fund those poor folk programs. Only 36% said, well, taxes should be kept low on the wealthy because, you know, they're the ones who job creators. So, you know, look, you know, 64% of us are kind of getting it. The job creator thing not working. And you look at, you know, as I've been pointing out, the rates have been falling. The investment, sorry, it's not creating the jobs that they said it would. We've tried this, seen the movie, not working. And now what do you have? You've got these CEOs running around under the guise of, oh, we're going to fix the debt. Yeah, I'm going to fix the debt. And what do they want? Well, they want to cut Social Security. They want to cut other entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid. They want to cut that stuff. And what I find hysterical about these CEOs who want to gotta push off retirement age, who want to, you know, limit the benefits or slow down the cost of living, people like Goldman Sachs' CEO Lloyd Blankenfein, who said that, well, you know, there'll be things that, you know, the retirement age has to be changed, and maybe some of the benefits have to be affected, maybe some of the inflation adjustments revised. Do you know what he's sitting on as a retirement? $12 million in retirement assets. He's not worried about Social Security. That's not his only source of income. He's not going to be screwed when they push this off another 2-3 years. He's not going to be screwed because, oh, as it's being eaten away by inflation, I can't even afford cat food. He's just fine. Thank you very much. And you go back to what they're doing here in the state, trying to screw these state workers and these teachers out of their pensions. Oh, no, Rick, they're trying to reform it. Yeah, they're trying to reform it like corporate America reformed their pension plans. Since 1985, 84,000 pension funds in this country have been eliminated, gone, done. And who got screwed? The workers. And now they're taking that corporate model because corporations know better, right? You know, like the guy in the hearing here said, oh, well, you know, why have corporations decided that 401ks are the way to go? Like Dr. Herzenberg said, because they don't have to fund them, ding-dong. It's a rip-off scheme. And they're trying to do the same thing to the public sector. And maybe they'll get away with it because, you know, we bought into it once. Let's take a quick break. I'm right back after this. Stick around.
And politicians, they own. They're getting corrupt. Intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Earth, sky.
Tuesday, November 27th. Full moon tonight and a penumbral eclipse of the moon.
This 2012 November full moon is the smallest full moon of this year. North America will see the penumbral eclipse of the moon before sunrise November 28th. As seen from the world's eastern hemisphere, Europe, Africa, Asia, Indonesia, Australia, and New Zealand, the full moon passes through Earth's penumbral shadow after sunset on November 28th.
This isn't a total eclipse of the moon, or even a partial. A penumbral eclipse is a very special kind of eclipse. The penumbra is the light outer shadow of Earth. What's happening is that this light shadow brushes the moon's face. Your best chance of noticing any shade at all on the moon's surface is at mid-eclipse, and in a dark sky, not obscured by dusk or dawn.
And actually, this eclipse might even be more exciting to watch if you could view it from the moon. At or near the moon's north pole, you'd see our planet Earth covering about 90% of the sun's diameter.
So that's tonight. Full moon, smallest full moon of the year, and a very subtle penumbral lunar eclipse. For eclipse times, visit the Tonight page at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So a huge, huge settlement, a huge court case. The federal court decided on a wage theft case. $13 million settlement for the workers who got, well, literally screwed out of back wages. And, you know, you think Walmart, yeah, they've taken wages from their workers. You think about these low-wage workers across the country, you know, working at retail shops or fast food joints. And, yeah, they're screwing their workers out of wages as well. But this is in the stripping industry. Evidently, these big clubs have been taking tips from the dancers for years, and the decision handed down, I guess it was, last week sometime, $13 million. I've got Melissa Guerra Grant, a journalist and former sex worker, also a former member of the Exotic Dancers Union, SEIU Local 790 on the line. Melissa, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey there, Rick. Great to be here.
So I guess this is a huge victory.
Yeah, it's one of the largest settlements there's been in the history of, strippers taking their employers to court, and it's certainly against one of the biggest chains. So the company that they won the suit against, or rather got the settlement from, is called Spearman Rhino. And they're an international you know, sex entertainment company. They have clubs all over the world. But for this case, dancers in California, Nevada, Kentucky formed this large class action suit. And they were able to prove that they had been classified as independent contractors illegally and that they had the right to all of those tips back that their employers had taken from them illegally.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's, the profession aside, it's still wage theft, and wage theft is what it is. And it's something that we should be looking at. Unfortunately, this went the right way. Explain how this whole thing works, because I always thought that, you know, the people that you see at these clubs, they work for the place that puts them on there. They're actually classified as, or attempted to classify them as, independent contractors?
That's correct. And most strip clubs, one notable exception is the one that I worked for in San Francisco, where we were treated as employees. We got a weekly paycheck. We had a time clock. We even had Social Security and benefits taken out. It was the real deal. We were treated like employees and you got all those benefits. In most clubs in the United States, what happens is you actually pay for the privilege to work.
No way.
So when you, when you show up for your shift and you're scheduled on shift, so already, you know, this sounds like you're an employee, not a contractor, right? You're scheduled for shift and you have a certain amount of maybe lap dances that you have to perform over the course of that shift. So you might have a quota of dances that you are responsible for. And if you don't achieve that quota, then you might be out money to the club. You're also expected at the end of your shift to make what's known as a tip out to all different kinds of service workers in the club. So rather than actually, you know, pay a decent wage to DJs, to cocktail waitresses, to bouncers, to other folks who make the club operate smoothly, dancers are responsible to directly pay those people out of their tips.
Wow, that's
and
a heck of a gig.
And then on top of that, they have to pay management, you know, a stage fee, which could be, in some clubs, several hundred dollars for an eight-hour shift.
Get out of here.
No, it's incredibly common. And time and again, I mean, this suit is just one of the biggest ones. There have been many over the past 10 or 15 years that dancers have been organizing and raising awareness among the industry that this is an illegal practice. And the clubs just keep trying to squirrel around it. You know, there hasn't, the lawsuit's really the best bet that people have to avoid getting screwed out of their money.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, the way you look at the way I, because as I was reading this, I'm going, well, you know, most people I know, well, you know, who cares about, they're just, you know, these strippers, who cares about them? But, you know, my thought was, these are working people like anybody else. I mean, it's the same as Walmart, it's the same as, you know, any of these companies.
Right, and in some cases it might even be the same workers. You know, this is a slightly different industry, but the Nevada brothel industry, which is one of the only legal prostitution industries in the United States, there is just a great study done by professors at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, working in sociology, looking at workers in the brothels, and they found that a third of the women working in those brothels were there because the low-wage work that they were doing, service work, retail work, wasn't allowing them to actually make ends meet. And that's part of what made the brothel work attractive to them.
Yeah.
So, you know, when everybody's bottom line is, you know, sinking, and when businesses all over are treating workers really poorly, that makes the sex industry an attractive option. It's just, you know, people aren't necessarily going to get treated any better there.
Yeah.
And they might make a little more money, but the club is going to make sure they get theirs too.
Oh, of course. I mean, it's another way of sticking it to the people at the bottom. You know, in your
exactly.
piece, Organized Labor's Newest Heroes, Strippers, you point out that there's this massive consolidation going on of these strip clubs. It's not small town, because I always thought, you know, it was a local small town thing. I didn't realize that you actually have, you know, as you pointed out, global corporations that do this.
Mm-hmm. Experiment Rhino is one of them. Deja Vu is another big example. When I was dancing in San Francisco, and this is about 7 or 8 years ago, there were only a handful of clubs, maybe 3 or 4, out of the dozen clubs in the city that were not owned by Deja Vu. And so what that meant, usually the way that people deal with getting treated poorly and stripping, and I did this when I worked, you know, in a more rural environment in New England, if, you know, one thing that happened to me at work one time when I was sick and I couldn't make a shift and I called in, I was told I wasn't allowed to return to work until I paid a $100 fine
Wow.
for being sick. So I just went to the next club down the highway. But if you work in a town where there's one corporate, you know, backer holding all of these clubs, maybe even operating under different business names, you can't do that. It's typically been one of the things that's made stripping flexible for dancers, is to be able to, you know, go from club to club and actually have a little autonomy. So when you see this consolidation, and with the consolidation comes a lot more rules of conduct in the workplace that definitely push people over into being employees and not independent contractors, and the clubs then expect more money out of the dancers to subsidize these lavish, you know, almost like bottle service, VIP kinds of experiences for their customers with cigar lounges, and, you know, it's all coming out of the dancers' pockets ultimately.
So the answer to me is then organizing, is giving them a voice in what goes on and giving them some power.
Exactly, and it's really challenging. I mean, to date, you know, the SEIU, at the time it was Local 790, I think now it's 1021 in San Francisco in 97, was the union local that organized the Lusty Lady. And, you know, they're still union, they're still there, but they're in, you know, an unusual position where they already regard their workers as employees. You know, today I was just at an event that the National Domestic Workers Alliance held to release their findings about how domestic workers are treated in the U.S., you know, and talk about another class of kind of excluded workers, women workers, low-wage workers who aren't really, by some people, you know, even regard it as doing real work because they're, you know, doing work that, you know, we think women should just be doing for free, taking care of people's kids. Like, I see a lot of similarities. And, you know, they're looking at ways to organize outside of a traditional union context because the work is different. And, you know, this is the new normal. Like, people are going to be taking on more kinds of flexible work. They're going to be working in contexts that don't look like, you know, the kinds of labor environments that, you know, classic union organizing really works well in. You know, SEIU is a great place to be in because, you know, the healthcare workers got it. Every time I hung out with SEIU healthcare workers, they were some of the most respectful folks when it came to talking about, you know, what we faced in dance clubs and, you know, what it was to do a woman to be a woman who was doing work. That, you know, we had to really fight for the right to be taken seriously as workers.
Yeah, and, you know, because the first thing I thought of as I was reading through your piece, I was thinking one of my older uncles who over the weekend I just had this conversation about the past election. And, you know, he said all women were thinking about is, you know, between their legs. And I'm going, well, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the right to contraception, the right to self-empowerment, the right to choose, you know, what they do with their own bodies, pretty important right. And the right for workers to be able to keep their wages, I think pretty important right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's all connected. I mean, one of the things that would be great for dancers to be able to pool together collectively is, you know, for healthcare. You know, people might make enough 1 week to pay into, you know, insurance if they could even afford to pay it out for themselves. But most people are having to take care of their healthcare needs on their own. And when you talk about sex work more broadly, not even just, you know, exotic dancing, but say you're talking about kinds of sex work that might be illegal, you're in a situation where people might not even want to disclose that to their medical provider.
Yeah.
You know, one of the places I worked also in San Francisco is the St. James Infirmary, and we called ourselves an occupational health and safety clinic for sex workers. So, you know, we were a safe place where people could come and, you know, talk to people who were going to not judge them for what they did for a living and also get their health care needs met. You know, some people thought, oh, you know, they're doing sex work. They need to get tested for HIV and to make sure they don't have STIs. But most of what we were doing was massage and chiropractic work, which makes sense, right, if you're working with your body. So that was a really important place for organizing, too. You know, people just need chances to come together and air their grievances in the sex industry, just like any other workforce. And, you know, that was a huge opportunity for people to, you know, break those walls of isolation that you might feel as a sex worker and see that, you know, like with me, like I know I'm not the only dancer who had to pay a fine in order to go back to work. And then once you know that, what are you going to do about it?
Well, you work to try and change the situation for the next folks. You know, so in looking at this unprecedented victory, if you will, this $13 million settlement, is this going to, do you think, have any impact on the industry? Are there going to be any teeth down the road to stop this behavior from happening, or is this just a bump in the road for them?
No, absolutely. I think, you know, major club owners are going to look at this, and they are going to see that there is a severe financial price to pay and a lot of time in court if they're going to illegally misclassify their workers as independent contractors. The other repercussions we might see from this, and this is something that has borne out as these suits have come up in the years, is club owners will just try to squirrel around it. So there's, you know, some clubs will say, all right, well, we're not going to allow customers to put money in your hand anymore because that will be a tip, but we're going to make you carry a little purse. And if customers put money in the purse, then the purse is the club's property, and therefore that's not a tip, and you're not entitled to it anymore. So they'll do these, you know, really kind of sketchy things to try to get out of having to treat workers fairly. And then the question is, well, then how do we hold them accountable there? This is going to be an ongoing fight.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it just popped into my head when I first met my wife. She was working as a tour guide, you know, doing with horses, and you would go on these trail rides, and at the end they'd give you an envelope that you were supposed to put money in that you thought, or I thought, or they led you to believe was a tip for the tour guides. Turns out that the people who own the tour company kept all that money. And they would say, well, at the end of the year, we'll give you a week's vacation, and that's even. I'm going, wait a minute, I gave you a lot more than a week's vacation there.
And I wonder if it's the kind of job, too, where they said to people, well, this is fun, right? Like, this is the kind of thing that you would be doing anyway. So, you know, you should just put up with this. And dancers hear that a lot. I mean, there's a great documentary that was made about the unionization of the club that I used to work at. It's called Live New Girls Unite. And there's scenes in there, you know, hot and heavy scenes of contract negotiations. But one of the things that the dancers pushed back on management for was they wanted to stipulate in the contract that their job was fun.
Yeah, I got to be honest.
And the dancers said, no, you can't put in the contract that our job is fun.
I don't know how you could even make that argument, because I've been to strip clubs in the past and I don't see any fun there. I look around and I go, this is just, to me, it's just creepy. And I can't imagine how someone would define that. Well, to me, it just is what it is.
I had fun at work some days, but my fun was definitely proportionate to, you know, how much money I was going home with at the end of the night and how good I felt about how it happened.
Yeah.
So it can be done, but it's, you know, it's hard. It's a competitive environment and, you know, it's still very stigmatized. So, you know, I think that actually the better workers are treated, maybe it will be a better experience for the customers.
Yeah, excellent point. Well, this is a historic victory, and maybe this will stop some of the wage theft, because it is what it is. It is wage theft. No matter what you think of the job, these are still workers who are being cheated, and I'm glad that at least some justice on this front was had.
Melissa, yeah, it's promising. Hopefully we can check back in if there's more. But thanks for having me on.
I would love to talk about it in the future. Melissa Guerra-Grant, I appreciate the time. Journalist, former sex worker, and former member of the Exotic Dancers Union, SEIU 790. Quick break, back after this. Stick around.
We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17.
That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into a thousand years of darkness.
Yes, a thousand years of darkness! Which, if we go off the Grand Cliff, if we go over the cliff, a thousand years of darkness. Oh, man. I mean, you listen to the rhetoric for, and it's not just something, this isn't new. I mean, that's something Reagan said back in the 60s. You know, if we do that Medicare thing, a thousand years of darkness, it's the end of civilization, it's the end of the world as we know it. Wow. Sad stuff. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You know, I listened to that story and, you know, the wage theft. And it's just not, you know, like I said, it's just not the big box retailers. It's just not, you know, the sweatshops, all the industries who have been caught. A lot of them are doing it. And you see the reports, workers are getting the shaft all the time. But, you know, you would think that in that kind of an industry, in the stripping industry, that it would be just the way it was. I mean, $13 million settlement. And I guess the question I should have asked is, you know, the $13 million settlement, how much did the workers actually lose? And, you know, think what you want about, you know, the people who do that job. They're like anybody else. Now, I've got more respect for them than I've got for the bankers on Wall Street than these people. These are people who actually work for a living, and to have their wages stolen from them is, to me, criminal, and something that our government should be working to do. And I'm hoping, as the days, weeks, and months go along, that we'll see more organizing, that we'll see more people saying, you know what, I'd like to have some say. Just a thought. USA Today report that I read today, wealth rises in USA's health heartland. Because of the big natural gas boom, you look at, North Dakota, which has seen, a significant rise in the average income, because they are the nation's number two oil producing state because of the Bakken oil field. But they went through some of the interesting findings of their report, one being, the Bridgeport, Stamford, Connecticut area, had the highest per capita income of any area in the country. The poorest communities in the country were in Texas, three areas in Texas, actually, the McAllen, Brownsville, and the Laredo area, where folks were making, somewhere around $21,000 a year, as opposed to almost $80,000 in the Bridgeport, Stamford area. They pointed out that, in Texas, in the oil fields there in Texas, people were making the highest wages, some of the highest paying jobs, $115,000 to be one of the oil hands. Only New York City had higher paying jobs last year. But the thing that caught my attention in this report were the benefits and, the entitlements. And, I've been really aware of, what it is that we're talking about. Unemployment, you're talking about, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, programs that help the poor, the bottom safety nets, unemployment benefits, stuff like that. And they pointed out the three bottom areas in the country. In fact, three counties in Kentucky, Owsley, McCreary, and Wolf County in Kentucky, are the only places in the country that rely on government programs, you know, such as Social Security, food stamps, and Medicaid for more than half of all of the income in the counties. Three counties. And you would go, well, you know, it must be those liberal Democrats who represent those counties, right? Wrong. Three Republicans. Republican Representative Brett Guthrie, Hal Rogers, and newly elected Representative Andy Barr. And you go, and what popped into my head is, how do you, as a voter in those counties, knowing that, you know, more than half of your existence, more than half of the income into your community that maybe supports the local small businesses and the local shops, comes from safety net programs. How do you then vote for people who say we're going to destroy them? Now, I'm not saying they're stupid. Misinformed, misguided, maybe. But I look at this and I go, you know, at some point, don't we have to have this conversation about who gets what? And I had this interesting discussion with my uncle over the weekend, who is extremely bitter about the election, extremely bitter that Romney lost. In fact, told me that he's no longer going to be raising money to help poor people. He's done until they appreciate it. That kind of stuck in my mind. I look at this and I go, you know, do you think that these folks in these three counties, do you think they appreciate it? And maybe there would be an awakening that if the Republicans gave them what they voted for, that they would come to light. I'm not sure. But I think about this last election, and what really caught my attention is the dividing in us. The dividing of us even further. This whole idea of the producers versus the takers. And what's amazing is most of the folks that I talk to, if you go through enough, you realize that they're takers too. It's not as black and white and as cut and dry as the right wanted us to believe. We can have an honest, rational discussion. We can. On how we solve our fiscal problems. But not with gimmicks, not with constructs, not with crisis, made-up crisis, not with these hostage situations, but with actual conversation and actual solutions. Possible? Impossible? I don't know. We're going to talk about it here in the third hour. We're going to take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Factory fires in Bangladesh highlight the importance of U.S. factory safety regulations, Jesse Russell reports.
It's a headline that could have been torn straight from the front page of a late 19th century newspaper reporting on the United States. More than 100 dead after being trapped in a garment factory fire. Except the story isn't unfolding 100 years ago in the United States. It unfolded in Bangladesh this weekend. The weekend fire, which claimed the lives of at least 112 workers, is being called one of the worst industrial accidents in that country's history. history. According to the Clean Clothes Campaign, more than 500 workers have died in Bangladesh factory fires over the last 6 years. Following the factory fire, thousands protested in the streets demanding the government address safety standards in those factories. One of the alleged reasons for so many deaths in the fire was that managers had padlocked the first floor doors, so workers were forced to jump from the roof to nearby buildings or out of windows. Such practices echo the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in 1911 New York City, when 146 garment workers died partially because managers had locked doors to stairwells and exits.
That clothing factory supplied Walmart and other major retailers. United Food and Commercial Workers President Joe Hansen says his union is proud to stand with the Walmart workers as they strike, protest, and do direct action protests to improve working conditions at Walmart and to inform customers about conditions there. Gregory Fletcher is a California Walmart worker.
They pay low. They pay very low. A lot of times people tell me, well, what, you know, you're not really a doctor, you're not a lawyer. I mean, you know, how much money do you expect to make at Walmart? But the point I make is that if the company's making over $400 billion a year in sales, I must be pretty valuable.
The National Domestic Workers Alliance is out with a new report showing domestic workers face not only poverty-level wages, but are also subject to high levels of abuse. Home Economics, the invisible and unregulated world of domestic work, surveyed more than 2,000 domestic workers in 14 U.S. cities. The report found that 23% are paid less than the minimum wage, and 48% of domestic workers are paid less than adequate wages to support a family. They're also subjected to verbal, physical, and psychological abuse on the job with no recourse. Ai-Jen Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, says these workers deserve protections afforded by U.S. law. The alliance is calling for including domestic workers in state minimum wage laws, adding them to workers' compensation and unemployment insurance programs, guaranteeing overtime pay, meal and rest breaks, and protecting domestic workers under all state and federal anti-discrimination laws. The Association of Minor League Umpires has re-elected President Sean Francis and also added two new executive board members. The association is a guild affiliated with the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. The new leadership will negotiate labor agreements for the umpires in 2013.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So I look at this campaign, fix the debt. Sounds like a great campaign, doesn't it? Hey, we got a debt problem, let's fix it, right? Roll up our sleeves, get our hands dirty. Run by CEOs, which, you know, you go, what do they know about getting their hands dirty? Not much. What are they calling for? Well, they're calling for cuts to Social Security and other entitlement programs. Entitlement programs. You know, those things that you paid for that, you know, you hope that when I get older and I can no longer work, that there'll be something for me at the end where I don't have to, you know, worry about living in poverty. You know those things? Those entitlements? Love how they frame it, don't you? Well, what they're calling for is, well, we need to lengthen the retirement age. Push it off several more years so that, you know, well, you know, you die before you get it. And I look at someone like Lloyd Blankenfein, who's the CEO of Goldman Sachs, who's, you know, out there saying, you know, well, we need to push that off. We need to adjust the inflation adjustment, you know, revise that. This is a guy who's sitting on, you know, about $12 million in retirement assets. And the folks at the Institute for Policy Studies, they released a report. It's titled A Pension Deficit Disorder, The Massive CEO Retirement Funds and Underfunded Worker Pensions at Firms Pushing Social Security Cuts. And they point out that the 71 Fix the Debt CEOs of public companies have average retirement assets in the area of $9.1 million. Of the 71 CEOs who are part of this Fix the Debt campaign, 54% participate in their company's retirement program and have collected pension assets, collective assets in the range of $649 million, more than $12 million per CEO. That would be enough to generate a check of $65,873 each and every month for life. $65,873. On average, the Social Security check for workers retiring, $1,237. They're worried about my grandmother who gets, she doesn't get $1,200. She gets less than that, but she's worried about somebody retiring. They're worried about somebody retiring with $1,200. They're going to walk away with almost $66,000. And that's the average. I mean, that's not the Blankenfeins who will, or the Jack Welches or any of those. No, no. They're worried about those folks at the bottom. A dozen of the fix the debt executives, according to the good folks at the Institute for Policy Studies, have more than $20 million in their individual company retirement accounts. Each of the CEOs converted their assets to an annuity. When they turned 65, they'd get at least $110,000 for life. And they're worried about $1,200 for people like you and me. Of the 71 publicly held fix the debt member companies, 41 of them provide employee pension funds for their workers. Of them, only two have sufficient assets in their pension funds to meet their obligations. Two. The rest have unfunded liabilities. Somewhere in the range of $103 billion, or about $2.5 billion each on average. And you look here in Pennsylvania where the governor and the Republicans are saying, well, we got this crisis, all the pensions, we got to do something about these pensions. They're going to do what corporate America has done. Trust me. You know what's, we've seen this movie. Since 1985, corporate America has eliminated 84,000 pension plans. And along with it, the obligation to those workers. Thank you, bankruptcy court judge. Write that right off. And now these CEOs, they're going after Granny. They're going after you and me and our future. And I look at this, and this again, they've created this crisis. And part of me believes, you know, this has been the plan all along. That they're so devious and so scheming that this was the plan years ago. That this was, and you know, part of me goes, I know it is, because I've read the same reports that they've been putting out from their right-wing think tanks on how do we destroy Social Security while making it look like we're actually saving it. Oh, we're going to save it. Like Alan Simpson, the Republican from former Republican senator from Wyoming said, we're going to save it by making it work like it used to. You know, the retirement age was 65 and people only lived to 57, so we're going to reform it so it works like it used to. To where you're dead 8 years before you're eligible to get any benefit out of it. Is that right? And for me, the longer we push off retirement age, what does that do for the younger generation? Are they going to be able to find jobs? Because the idea is that you have a turnover of people every so often so that jobs open up and the next generation takes over, pays those taxes, does all that stuff, right? So as I look at this mirage, I look at this construct, this extortion scheme, because it is what it is, that they've created this situation that they've created to try and strong arm us and extort us into giving up future benefits. I'm hoping that you see this. I'm hoping that people are wise to this by now. Because in every fight, no matter what it is, whether it was the minimum wage fight several years back, or it was the debt ceiling debacle, or no matter what it is, they've got to extract something from us. They've got to get their pound of flesh. You know, you look at the crisis that they created with unemployment in this state. It's brilliant what they've done. It's brilliant what the right-wing anti-government people have done in this country. Absolutely brilliant. Because they can't lose. You get the guy in there who throws the monkey wrench into the system, puts the poison pill in the bill, and then sits back and allows the poison pill to work. And then turns around and says, see, it doesn't work. I screwed it up, yes, but I told you it didn't work. It's brilliant. And then you get a whole bunch of angry people calling into talk radio. Oh, see, I listen to the right-wing shows all the time. Angry people are ticked off at government because you know what? Republicans have run things into the ground. It's their policies. It's just like I look at Obamacare. There are things I don't like about it. And they're mainly the right-wing ideas. For me, if you wanted to save Medicare, if you wanted to give insurance to everybody in this country, you just open Medicare up. Let me buy into it. Let healthy people buy into it instead of insuring the sickest people. Now, understand what the Medicare debate was supposed to be, and I was surprised. I got to be honest. I was surprised that they weren't able to divide the generations even further. And that's a testament to the fact that older citizens were going, hey, I think I want my kids to have this. And younger people go, wait a second, I don't want granny getting kicked to the curb. And, oh, by the way, I'd like to have those benefits because I see how well they work for my grandmother. But they really, they tried. They tried to put that wedge there, didn't work, but they tried. And the same thing with this whole debt debacle, this whole fiscal mirage. You know what our crisis is? And we do have a true crisis. Understand, there's a crisis going on in this country, and it's a jobs crisis. If we could get people back to work, hey, by the way, we could create jobs. We could fix our debt problems. And you look at this new paper by the San Francisco Federal Reserve. Surprise, surprise, they found that if we invested in things, you know, stuff like infrastructure, that it actually has a reverberation effect on the short and medium terms. It's going to have benefits to our economy. In fact, each dollar, they say, that we invest in infrastructure boosts the state's economy by at least $2. They said federal highway grants to states appear to boost economic activity in the short and medium term. The short-term effects appear to be due largely to the increase in aggregate demand. Oh, wait a second. I think we've talked about demand, right? Yeah, we have. When you get money in people's pocket, they generally go to stores and they buy stuff. And that's demand. That's right. Oh, yes. They point out medium-term effects apparently reflect the increased productivity capacity brought by improved roads. Overall, they say each dollar in federal highway grants received by a state raises the state's annual economic output by at least two, a relatively large multiplier. In other words, for each dollar federal highway grants received by a state, the state's GSP rises by at least $2. Are we surprised in that? And the answer is no. It's something that we shouldn't be surprised at. And as we've said before, you know, and I'll use Stephen LaTourette, the Republican from Ohio who's retiring. You know, who said for every $1 billion that we invest in infrastructure, for every $1 billion that we invest, it creates 42,000 jobs. And you know what those jobs do? Especially the ones that pay a decent wage, a prevailing wage. You know, the things that the Republicans want to go after and destroy because, hey, if we can get them working for $1 an hour, That's better. But you get money into those workers' pockets by creating those jobs? Because we got a lot of people who need work right now. What would it do for the local economy? Now, I understand that our governor is, well, attempting to dust off his Transportation Commission's report. Hey, election's coming up, 2014, the big election. He's going to run for re-election, so now he's got to push for this transportation bill, which he knows is going to create jobs. As I've been saying for the longest time, strategically he's going to roll that out to make himself look good in 2014. And a big part of it is going to be that transportation bill because it's going to get people back to work. I wish he'd have done it last year or maybe the year before. You know, so our economy gets moving and people get back to work. But I guess that would be too much to ask, wouldn't it? we've got more important things to do, like sell off state assets, like privatize the wine and spirit shops and privatize the lottery and go after public workers' pensions. Making 2012 the year of the Bible, so many things to do, so little time. You know, real important work. The stuff that we send them here to Harrisburg to do, right? Not so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
One of the proudest progressive victories of the November elections was produced by some scrappy citizens in the burg of Brecksville, Ohio, population 14,000. Organized under the banner of Brecksville Citizens for Transparent Politics, they decided they needed to speak out about the U.S. Supreme Court's outrageous edict allowing unlimited sums of corporate cash to flood secretly into America's elections. So they collected signatures to qualify an initiative for the local ballot, calling for a U.S. constitutional amendment, quote, to establish that corporations are not people and money is not speech. A couple of states and dozens of cities proposed similar initiatives, but Brecksville's unique proposal added a useful bit of oomph to the call. If passed, it would require city officials to designate one day in February for the next 10 years as Democracy Day, on which the mayor would host a citywide hearing about how the surge of campaign money was affecting the city. After the hearing, the mayor must send a letter to the legislature and Congress proclaiming the citizens' opposition to corporate electioneering. Mayor Jerry Ruby, however, balked at this outbreak of democracy, saying it required the city to take an official position on a federal issue outside its jurisdiction. He went to the Board of Elections to disqualify it from the November ballot, but the board deadlocked, and the matter went to Ohio's Secretary of State. To the mayor's surprise, this Republican official broke the tie in favor of the citizens. Then, the mayor appealed to the Ohio Supreme Court, where, finally, with barely a month to go, a 5-2 majority of the judges ruled that the people's proposal was legit. This is Jim Hightower saying, completing this triumph of citizens' perseverance, 52% of Brecksvillians proudly voted the initiative into law on Election Day. See? It is possible to fight City Hall. And win.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Family values! Family values! Yes, we need more family values. Anybody remember Brad State? He was running for Congress in Tennessee, Republican, running against Jim Cooper, the Democrat there, who who was reelected in this last cycle, 65 to 32%. But you know, he gained some notoriety, if you remember, that he had published a picture of a semi-automatic firearm on his Facebook page with the message, "Welcome to Tennessee, Mr. Obama." So he got a little notoriety for that. It didn't help him at the polls any, but it did get his name and did catch my attention. So when I saw Mr. State was arrested, charged with domestic violence, misdemeanor domestic assault, for beating his wife, there's a guy who, now this is the family matters candidate, the good, God, fair, and Christian candidate, one of those conservative values people who says we need to have marriage inequality, we need to make sure it's a man or woman. He wanted to deny women the right to choice, to decide what they do with their own body, and of course going after those illegals. You know, good family values guy. Evidently, you know, decided he was angry, gave the wife a good slap, good beating, if you will. So I guess when he runs for the next office, which I'm sure he probably will, or maybe this will end that bright, shining career, I guess that the question, do you still beat your wife, would be appropriate. And I love these stories because you get these people who, you know, they put themselves out as, well, I'm the family values guy. Or I'm, you know, the good, God-fearing Christian guy. And you see stuff like this. Like the other guy who, you know, running on the family values platform, wants his mistress to have an abortion. While he's out there saying we should make abortion illegal. You know, because with his mistress. And remember, the queers, they're gonna ruin the sanctity of his marriage. Not him cheating on his wife and getting someone pregnant. No, that's not going to harm the marriage at all. You want to talk about sour grapes? The Republicans still chafing. And, you know, my uncle very chafed over the election, very angry that the Romney lost. Going to take his ball and go home like a lot of these Republicans. But one state senator, a woman from Idaho, her name is Cheryl Nuxall. She was very angry, and she is putting forth the idea that the T-Twits are circulating in their blogs, that somehow if the Romney delegates, the electors who from states like Idaho who voted for Romney, if they don't show up, there won't be a quorum. So Obama can't win. She tweeted a last chance to have Mitt Romney as president in January. It's still not too late. Election more, and she has a little link to this thing. And pushing this idea that, you know, if there's no quorum, that the Electoral College can't make the decision. But here's the problem. She's wrong. dead wrong. But, you know, it is, well, according to the Constitution, and again, I guess you have to read this stuff a little bit. You do need a quorum in the House of Representatives, two-thirds, not the Electoral College. But again, you know, hey, facts don't matter. We can still win. Yay! Sour grapes. But I thought, you know, over the weekend, I was amazed at the level of sour grapes. And my uncle, who is a very philanthropic guy and really somebody that, you know, I've always thought of as a decent, you know, employee, and I still do. I mean, he's still a decent guy to work for. People, you know, say that. I worry when he retires how what kind of no good for Nick's his kids are going to be. But you know, like all businesses. But he's always been one of those guys who does for charity. He's always been one of those guys who's willing to reach out and help people in need. And you know, to see this kind of bitterness, because this election did this. This election cycle really, really made that dividing line clear. That people like him and really sucked him into it. I thought, and I'm still hoping that he'll come out of this and wake up and realize that it's really a wrong frame. But what they really tried to highlight is they really tried, and I think in a lot of cases did a very good job of pitting cities against rural areas, pitting working people against business owners. I mean, causing that grief, you know, just in the workplace. I guess I was a little surprised at how far they were willing to go. Because I do believe that the wealth class thought that this was the time. If they were going to be able to buy our nation, if they were going to be able to completely control things, this was it. And you look at the money that they spent, the money they poured into, who even my uncle agrees, a guy who ran one of the worst campaigns in the history of campaigning. You know, maybe the only worst campaign I can think of in my lifetime was run by Mondale. And he got thumped for it. But really just a bad campaign all the way around. But what they did do is they kept highlighting that, well, you know, and Mike Fitzpatrick's the congressman from here in Pennsylvania. He said, well, you know, well, we want people who sign the front of the check, not in the back of it. You know, more of that division. And as I said over the weekend as we were talking about this, and I said, you know, my hope now is that we can heal those wounds. I don't know that you can, though. Because he really, truly, I mean, in his tone and in the conversation we had, very slighted, very angry, bitter. And it just said, you know, I'm not going to do this stuff anymore. Which then leads me back to the conversation that I've had numerous times with religious people who believe that nothing charitable should be done by we the taxpayers. We shouldn't have a social safety net. We shouldn't provide health insurance for the poor. We shouldn't provide food for the poor. We shouldn't do any of those things. That is the job of the churches. And while I agree that they should do these things, because it is biblically their calling, right? You know, do to others as you would do to me. You know, if you see somebody hungry, imagine that it's me that's hungry. You see somebody that's thirsty, imagine that it's me that's thirsty. That is kind of the calling. But understand, and I bring it back to this conversation that I had, where I'm thinking, man, you know, now you're going to pull back because you lost this election? Because your team lost? And the people who are at the margin, the most vulnerable, they're going to suffer because you got slighted? I don't want people to have that kind of control. I've always said I want boring bureaucrats. I want government policy that's going to make sure that every kid in this country has enough to eat, has a decent education, sees a doctor when they're sick, and every person has a right to health care. In the most powerful, wealthiest country in civilization, you think that should be a minimum. But I look at this, and my conversation with him just really solidified my belief that I don't know that I want the churches doing all of that. That's not the primary place where I want it done. Do I want them doing it? Sure. They do good work in some instances. But we also subsidize that. And that was a conversation you really wanted to highlight. But, you know, look, I love my uncle. I think he's in his heart, I think he has the right ideas. But, you know, the worry is that you've got a lot of folks like him who believe that they're the producers and they're entitled to something. And that's, I guess, always been my problem with charity and people who do it. I don't think I've ever asked. When I give money to charities or do work for charities, I don't think I've ever asked for anything in return. No, I don't want any notoriety. I don't want any accolades. I think this election, I think this highlighted a lot of that, though. And I remember, you know, I've gotten a bunch of emails from people who say, well, you know, conservatives, they're more charitable. And I disagree with that. I think they give more to churches. But I don't believe they're more charitable. Not at all. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Tuesday, November 27th, full moon tonight, and a penumbral eclipse of the moon.
This 2012 November full moon is the smallest full moon of this year. North America will see the penumbral eclipse of the moon before sunrise November 28th. As seen from the world's eastern hemisphere, Europe, Africa, Asia, Indonesia, Australia, and New Zealand, the full moon passes through Earth's penumbral shadow after sunset on November 28th.
This isn't a total eclipse of the moon, or even a partial. A penumbral eclipse is a very special kind of eclipse. The penumbra is the light outer shadow of Earth. What's happening is that this light shadow brushes the moon's face. Your best chance of noticing any shade at all on the moon's surface is at mid-eclipse, and in a dark sky, not obscured by dusk or dawn.
And actually, this eclipse might even be more exciting to watch if you could view it from the moon. At or near the moon's north pole, you'd see our planet Earth covering about 90% of the sun's diameter.
So that's tonight. Full moon, smallest full moon of the year, and a very subtle penumbral lunar eclipse. For eclipse times, visit the Tonight page at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
So it's not even been 9 months yet since the Trayvon Martin shooting. Not even 9 months. And it looks like another situation in Florida. According to the Orlando Sentinel, and this is one of those things that just kind of makes you go, what is wrong with people? And this is why I worry about everybody having guns. Evidently on Friday, according to the Orlando Sentinel, this guy, you know, Michael Dunn is his name, was a 45-year-old guy, vice president of Dunn and Dunn Data Systems in Vero Beach, right there near Jacksonville. He was driving around and pulled his car into a parking lot, where this African-American teenager, 17-year-old Jordan Russell Davis, was sitting with his friends in an SUV listening to some music, maybe a little too loud. And according to the Orlando Sentinel, Jordan and Dunn exchanged words, and the 45-year-old vice president of Dunn and Dunn Data Systems pulled out a gun, shot 8 or 9 times, killing Jordan. And, the more I thought about it, kid was sitting in the back seat, music was a little loud. Dunn's attorney
the shooter, claims that her client acted responsibly and in self-defense. However, she did not elaborate. And I guess, you know, hey, loud music equals, well, gunfire. Wow. Wow. Just amazing to me. But stand your ground, because that music could hurt your ears. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. I'm sure there's some insanity there. I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, loud music, death penalty, what do you think?
Beyond me. Beyond me.
That's just amazing to me. He standing his ground, he was.
Yeah.
He wanted that music turned down.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some other insanity. Did you hear? The end of the world is coming, and it's like 35 days from now. It's the fiscal mirage, as I've been calling. It's the end of the world. That's it. It's all over.
It's all over. It's all over. It's coming. And so what do we do? What do we do?
Capitulate.
No, we have PR strategies.
Oh, okay.
We have PR strategies. We get out of town. We go and talk to people about it. Talk to real Americans, meet with the owners of small businesses.
Yep.
Tell members of our party to go meet with the owners of small businesses. And meanwhile, I imagine that there are people at a staff level talking about it, but I'm not really sure.
Not sure. But it's the end of the world. We're sure of that. Because, you know, my grandmother was worried. She's going, you know, if I don't give up half of my Social Security now, the country is going to just cease to exist. And what will my great-grandchildren do?
No, it is. It is, yes.
Okay, well, gee, I'm sure glad that we cleared that up. I got 35 days to get my affairs in order. I mean, is this ridiculous or what?
I don't know if it is or if it isn't, but I know that it's either a cliff or a slope, of course, depending who you speak to.
It's a mirage. I mean, they've created another one of these hostage situations where they've got my grandmother all worked up that they're going to steal her Social Security or Medicare is going to be under attack. Because according to the Republicans, well, they're willing to compromise. Have you seen Lindsey Graham and the rest of them? Oh, we're willing to compromise as long as we steal Granny's Social Security and you do away with those entitlements.
Yeah, we'll compromise as long as you'll give us everything.
Yeah, we'll take it all and we'll call that compromise. And do what Romney said they were going to do in the first place and say that we're compromising.
Yes, we'll take Romney's position. Yeah.
So what do you think of Corker's 10-year, $4.5 trillion, what was it, 245-page document that he's gonna fix the whole thing all by himself.
I have a lot of admiration for Bob Corker.
Good for you. What's his view?
Well, I mean, I have an admiration for a man that actually had a plan.
All right.
I mean, it's a $4.5 trillion plan, okay. 10 years. It's got all kinds of controversial proposals. It's got a less generous inflation adjustment for Social Security. Gradual increase in the regular Social Security retirement age to 68, Medicare eligibility to 67, caps itemized deductions of $50,000, various other things. And it is very, very long, but it's about the only detailed proposal that we've seen from any Republican.
I thought that's what Simpson Bowles was, and I thought that's what the Ryan plan was. I thought they had a whole bunch of plans. I thought there were tons of plans.
Well, no, but I mean, a new plan.
Oh, okay.
Well, Simpson-Bowles was bipartisan, and that's really not acceptable. Ultimate, that isn't acceptable to Republicans once you get past talking points because it raises taxes.
Right. But, you know, I keep hearing the Lindsey Grahams and the Saxby Chambliss's and the other Republicans, some of them saying, you know, hey, we're not, and Corker as well, saying, you know, we signed the pledge, but we're willing to break that if we have to. For the good
yes.
of the country, if I remember Lindsey Graham saying, for the good of the country.
Yes, Grover Norquist is not happy.
The impure thoughts have gotten into
yes.
the heads.
So happy. He really is feeling very betrayed, I think, at this point. And
he should. His pledge is stupid.
His pledge is not holding up, and I think he may be plotting some kind of revenge.
Well, I don't doubt that. But at the end of the day, I mean, the revenge should be against him. I mean, you think of all of these people that have signed this idiotic pledge where you're basically saying that no matter what happens, I am never, and this is what the pledge basically says, if we have another depression, I'm never going to raise taxes, I'm never going to do anything to help us meet the need. I don't think I would ever sign any pledge that locked me into any position forever.
Forever. And it's not just raising taxes. It's changing deductions. It's adjusting anything.
But, you know, there was a story going around today that I saw that he said, you know, I guess back in 2011, that by allowing the Bush tax cuts to expire, that technically wasn't a violation of the pledge. So I'm all in favor of letting them expire.
I see.
I was against passing them in the first place. I've been against extending them, and now I'm even more against extending them further.
Okay.
Yes. Not going there with me?
Well, I mean, Grover's been contorting himself the last week, is my sense of it. This seems to me the further example.
Yeah. Well, he's got to keep it to where, you know, people still think he's a player, so they keep giving him money.
Yes, that's exactly what he's got to do, so that people keep giving him money. That's what he's got to do. He's got to keep that machine churning.
Yep, and you know, keep him well healed. Let's move along from the fiscal mirage, since the end of the world isn't 35 days. Let's see what else we can get into. Evidently, Susan Rice had a couple of meetings with some key Republicans. How'd that go?
Not well.
Surprise.
Well, no, not entirely, although things looked like they were going to be working out okay before she went into the meeting. People seemed to have been softening their tones. Everybody seemed like they were starting to get along. Then she went into the meeting with Senator Graham, McCain, and Ayotte came out. She was with acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell, and they went before the camera, and they all said they were much more disturbed than before the meeting. And they were really, really freaked out. And you couldn't tell why. And then eventually they put out a statement in which they said they asked Morell, and all the focus of their outrage was directed at her. And then in the statement they say they asked Morell who changed the unclassified talking points, all of which, by the way, has already been answered in testimony,
right,
to remove references to Al-Qaeda. And they say that he said that the FBI removed the references and did so to prevent compromising an ongoing criminal investigation. We were surprised by this revelation and the reasoning behind it. However, at approximately 4 this afternoon, CIA officials contacted us and indicated that Acting Director Morell misspoke in our earlier meeting. The CIA now says that it deleted the Al-Qaeda references, not the FBI. They were unable to give us a reason as to why. We are disturbed by the administration's continued inability to answer even the most basic questions about the Benghazi attack and the administration's response. But I don't see what that has to do with putting a hold on Ambassador Rice.
Yeah, I don't either. Yeah, Morell's an idiot. Okay, you go after him. If he said something wrong, you go after that. But what did that have to do with her? She simply said what was put in front of her, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, all of this backs up the claim that she just did what she had in front of her. She said what she had in front of her.
Yes.
So what's their hang-up?
I don't know.
And, you know, I was thinking about this today. You know, I remember the whole thing with Condoleezza Rice. They didn't seem to oppose her, did they?
No. No, they said this is what John McCain said, that the election was over and that any lingering bitterness should sort of be resolved, and it sounded like that they were just going after her.
And are they?
Well, that's what John McCain said at the time. I'm just quoting him.
Yeah, well, that's what I want. I saw this Tom Ricks guy was on Fox News, and they basically just shut him off. What's going on there?
Well, that was so interesting. He was invited on for a 3-minute interview. They shut him down after 90 seconds after he said that in reply to a question. Now, you should be clear about this. In reply to a question, he said that Second, I think that the emphasis on Benghazi has been extremely political, partly because Fox was operating as a wing of the Republican Party.
That's the end of
it. And he said, okay, thank you, goodbye. And at that point, off he went. Well, there was a bit of lead up to that. Today, the story developed because Michael Clementi, Fox's executive vice president of news, told The Hollywood Reporter yesterday that Ricks was not only seeking publicity with his guest appearance, ignored the interview question, and said that he apologized.
He was sorry.
That he apologized, and Rick said, no, I didn't. And that he, for being rude, and he said, no, I didn't.
Hmm. So what?
He also says that The Hollywood Reporter didn't bother to contact him. And he also says that Fox News is making it up. He says Clementi is making it up and just sloppy of The Hollywood Reporter not asking for specifics. What exactly am I alleged to have said? Why are they doing this? Because their MO is that when the facts aren't on their side, they attack that person.
Not surprising there. I mean, that is the Fox MO. Interesting. Also, it looks like four servicewomen are suing the Department of Defense because they can't fight in combat.
Yeah, this is a really interesting story. These are four servicewomen who've all been in Afghanistan or Iraq, two are Purple Heart recipients. Today, they filed a lawsuit against the DOD under the 14th Amendment, accusing them of violating servicewomen's rights to equal protection under the law by maintaining policies collectively known as the Combat Exclusion Rule. And the Pentagon is reforming the policies directed at servicewomen, but the rules do still bar women in the U.S. from specific combat positions.
Right.
And but Pentagon officials do plan to develop gender-neutral physical standards and research further reform to the combat exclusion policies, but obviously they haven't done that yet. So this is a really interesting lawsuit.
Yeah, I mean, I find it interesting that it's under the Equal Protection Act, that they're going to put them in harm's way.
Yeah.
Very, very strange. I'm also looking forward to January. There's talk that there may be some reform on the filibuster. Personally, I would love to see a filibuster like we saw on the movies in years past, where they actually have to stand and hold the floor and do them, get out the cots and the water jugs and the little portable bathroom jugs if you have to, and actually hold the floor.
I know. I think we all are. We're all just longing for that. We're all going to be glued to the first one, I think. See who's actually going to do it. Is it going to be Mitch McConnell? Who's it going to be? And it looks as though it's getting closer because Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell are exchanging words on the viperish, poisonous words on the Senate floor each day, both yesterday and today. And it's looking more likely by the day.
And I think that's how it should be. I'm going to pick up the phone and put a hold on something, and that's going to be the end of it. That's nonsense. Get out there and make your argument. And we put it on CNN and let me watch it for 24 or 48 or however long you can go. And at the end of it, let's have a vote. On both sides of the issue. Look, I mean, when the Republicans controlled things, I was not in favor of filibusters either.
Yeah.
So where do you think it's going to go?
I think it's going to happen. I think I think he's going to do it. I think he's going to change the rules with 51 votes rather than 67, which is going to make the Republicans furious. I think he's going to do that, and I think he's going to change these filibustering. The time it would take to break a filibuster be shorter. Make the motion to debate a bill, not the vote to pass it, immune to the filibuster. And make whoever is filibustering have to hold the floor of the Senate and talk. I think he's going to do those three things.
Yeah, and not just read Moby Dick, but actually stay on topic. Like Bernie Sanders did when he did it. I think he did it, what, 8-10 hours?
Oh, it was a long time. I don't think I stayed with it the whole time.
It was definitely a long time. And finally, how was your Thanksgiving holiday?
It was fun. I ate so much too much.
There you go.
And I saw James Bond, though.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I knew you're a big fan there. And how was it?
It was phenomenally good.
Good. All right. Did you go out on Thursday, on Black Friday early to the, you know, the Walmart or the...
No, I would not go shopping on Friday. I will not support that worker exploitation.
Good for you. That's what I love about you, Victoria. Always great talking with you. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Gamley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Gamley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Gamley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pscu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
We took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women.
Never mind. Binders! Binders full of women! Yes, yes, binders! I gotta be honest, I miss the whole primary. I miss the whole Republican debacle. I miss all of it. It was good and entertaining. It was exactly what it was. Speaking of entertaining, Two and a Half Men. You know, I got to be honest, I don't watch very often. Occasionally, funny. Kind of stupid, dumb, kind of, you know, laugh at nonsense. Yesterday we talked about the kid on the show, Angus T. Young, who was talking to some religious, you know, giving his video testimonial for the Forerunner Christian Church, where he said basically, you know, stop watching it, it's filth. Don't, haven't you seen the studies? Watching television rots your brain. Don't do it. I wouldn't watch it. I don't want to do it. I hate it. Stop watching so I can get out of it. And I was going, you know, hey, $350,000 an episode. How long is it going to be? And before he comes begging, it didn't take long. Back on his knees, the apology statement, forthright. Not going to be back on the set for a while. Doesn't have to face the producers, but came out with his statement. He says, I have been the subject of much discussion, speculation, and commentary over the last 24 hours. He says, while I cannot address everything that has been said or right every misstatement or misunderstanding, there's one thing I want to make clear. Without qualification, I am grateful to and have the highest regard and respect for all of the wonderful people on Two and a Half Men with whom I have worked over the past 10 years and have become an extension of my family. But it's still filth! And it's still, don't waste your time, and I don't want to do it, because I don't want the $350,000. He goes on to say, Chuck Lorre, Peter Roth, and many other Warner Brothers and CBS are responsible for what has been one of the most significant experiences of my life to date. I thank them for the opportunity that they have given and continue to give me, and help and guidance I have and expect to continue to receive from them. Can anyone say suck up? Dug myself a hole by saying something dumb. Gonna lose my $350,000 an episode paycheck. Better start digging deep. Bend over. Here it comes. He goes, well, I also want all the crew and the cast on our show to know how much I personally care for them and appreciate their support, their guidance, and love over the years. I grew up around them, and I know that they spent time with me. And it was in those many instances more than with their own family. I've learned life lessons from so many of them and will never forget how much positive impact they've had on my life. But it's filth! It's filth! It's no good! Don't watch it! He says, I apologize for my remarks. If they reflect me showing indifference to and disrespect of my colleagues and lack of appreciation for an extraordinary opportunity of which I have been blessed, I never intended that. Then what did you think it's filth meant? I guess, well, never mind. It is what it is. So there you go. Angus has gone back and began the whole suck-up process. Anyway, tomorrow on the program, I'm going to talk more about the fiscal mirage. You know, tomorrow, 34 days till the end of the world. It's over. It's done. If we go over the made-up cliff, it's all over. So be back here tomorrow and see what happens. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray.